in on. Perhaps you came overland from the east, for you have a bit of that eastern look about you."
He entertained them with fanciful tales, all of which were true but sounded false to their ears, that he was born in a place where every fresh tide altered the contours of the land, that a dragon ate his father, that his mother was a crow. All the while, he surreptitiously studied the women crowded at their ease on the other side of the fence, as at a cheerful roost. They were all females of the laboring class, washerwomen with lye-scarred hands, street sellers whose baskets of walnuts and onions sat at their feet, street sweepers dozing against their brooms. It had long been his observation that women labored from before sunrise to long after sunset. Sitting in a tavern late at night to hear the pronouncements of a radical who wielded words like the deadliest of swords might well be the most restful patch of their year. His gaze caught on a young woman with a lively face, who seemed unable to sit still. She had brought a bit of mending to do, as women were wont, there always being some tear or fray that needs repair, as a bird must endlessly tend to its feathers. Sewing kept her hands busy, but it was her long, thick braid of hair, as glossy a black as his own, that made him twitch, as if he'd been pricked by a needle wielded by an invisible hand.
"What do you think of our fine harbour and the countryside hereabout?" they asked, for he had fallen inexplicably silent.
"The provinces of Rome I call a fair and lovely land, for all that its skies and earth are so very different from my homeland," he answered. "Yet this is the first time here in Roman territory I've seen women seated in a tavern, as if they are accustomed to take their ease where men usually perch. Usually Roman women stay home."
"We're a port town, not a staid Roman oppidum. Anyway, women as much as men flock to any meeting where there's a chance the honeyed voice will speak. Men for her beauty, and women for her exhortations and her knife."
"The honeyed voice?" He sat up straighter. "What knife does she wield?"
"The knife of persuasion."
The fiddles ran down a cadence and ceased. One man elbowed another as a table was cleared at the far end of the room.
"Here she comes!"
cried one of his interlocutors with an eager smile. The crowd made way for three figures, a short, curvaceous woman flanked on either side by a tall individual of the people known as the Feathered Ones. These two had narrow jaws, vicious claws, and the slightly bobbing walk of a people who seemed a blend of human, bird, and lizard. Although soberly dressed as respectable lawyers, the Feathered Ones betrayed their true nature in having the toothy grins of dangerous beasts. In a chamber so filled with the strong scent of humanity, their dry, summer-burnt smell faded away almost to nothing. But he took in a deep breath to make his chest bigger and himself thus more threatening, lest they look his way and think they must attack. Then, recalling prudence, he hunched instead, so neither would mark him with its roving gaze. Not that the Feathered Ones had any reason to recognize him for what he was. Like humans, they were creatures of this world. He was truly alone, the only murder of his kind he had ever found in all the long and lonely years living in exile. A shout arose from the company all around, as the Feathered Ones helped the petite woman up to stand on the tabletop. Taken utterly by surprise by her exquisite features and magnificent poise, Apollo Crow jumped to his feet to get a better look. With delighted remonstrations, his companions tugged him back down to the bench.
"Did we not say she would astound you?"
They laughed, as the vision raised her arms with a gesture that invited the chattering audience to be quiet.
"Listen, and you will hear. My comrades, my friends, my sisters."
The women in the room ululated, then hushed expectantly.
"I am come into a hostile land, bearing a message for those of you who seek freedom. The yoke of tyranny harnesses you, yet it can be thrown off here, as it has been elsewhere in Europa."
She spoke in a compelling tone that, without apparent effort, filled the large room, so no listener need strain to hear. With effortless eloquence, she lectured on the means by which the rich and powerful aggregate wealth and favor for themselves and exploit those who toil under their lash. She described in convincing detail the creation of a governing assembly in the city of Havery, presided over by the prince of that territory, but subject to no master except itself. Half the room leaned forward as she detailed how the elections for representatives to this assembly included women, while the other half exchanged troubled looks. Yet all listened, for she had the gift of speech that made every word bloom from her mouth into a flower, and so that every sentence became a fragrant bouquet. "It is true that by ancient Roman law, women are forbidden from holding magistracies, priesthoods, triumphs, badges of office, or spoils of war. But what is law if not words written by hands?" She went on, as if the men's surly glances and hot murmurs impelled her to harden her phrases. "What the hand works can be made or unmade, as times change and philosophies take new paths. This is our new path, if we wish to walk it." "Is she an actress?" Apollo Crowe demanded of his new friends. The men hushed him with slaps on the arm, for however appalled they might be by her rhetoric, they were also entranced by her person and her voice.
"No actress. She has roused the hearts of people all across Europa. They say the emperor would imprison her if only he could catch her."
A dangerous woman indeed, if you were emperor over all of the Romans and feared the discontent that simmered beneath the surface of the normally silent plebeians. She was the fire coaxing the water to boil, and a fine, fierce blaze she was. But whatever else he might think, he had a job to do and a curse that bound him. When at length she finished her speech to thunderous applause, he winkled a gold chain from one of the many pockets secreted about his clothing, where he kept the bits and bobs he collected on his travels. He caught the collar of a passing child, young enough to be allowed to wander both sides of the fence. "There is a denarius in it for you if you take this gold chain to the honeyed voice and let her know what man sent it."
"What if I just steal the chain and run away and never come back?"
the child asked, perplexed by such a naive offer, and also staring greedily at the glittering links.
"Let me assure you, I never forget a face."
Apollo Crowe's smile made the child shudder. "If you disoblige me, then I promise that one day you will find yourself set upon by crows and pecked to death, with no one the wiser." The child pretended to laugh to save face, but at the same time cast a frightened look to either side, seeking escape. Yet the possibility of earning a denarius was no trivial inducement. After less of a hesitation than Apollo Crowe had expected, the child fished both chain and coin out of his hand and ducked under the rope. As he had known they would, the women pressing forward to speak to the honeyed voice allowed the child to slip through their ranks, for women always made room for hatchlings. She dipped to listen as the child spoke. Her shoulders tensed in surprise as she looked up to scan the chamber. Her gaze met his. The light was a little too dim, and she a little too far away, for him to read the subtleties of her reaction. But he could guess by her shifts in posture that she was displeased, and yet also tickled by an incurable swell of curiosity. Hard not to notice that she took in several bosom-heaving breaths. He lifted his mug to salute her. The men around him, captured by the gesture, applauded and laughed, praising him for his steely nerve. Everyone knew, they said, that the honeyed voice had no patience for men who tried to bribe her with gifts. She chose as she wished for interest, not for gain. She handed the gold chain to a woman who stood beside her, and indicated that the other woman should return the rejected bauble to him. Then, with an empty hand pretending to hold a non-existent cup, she saluted him back. He was abruptly head over tail in love with the challenge. Oddly enough, the woman entrusted with the necklace was the very same seamstress he had noticed before. He hadn't noticed her leaving her bench, and therefore studied her more closely as she approached. Her clothes were sturdy, not fancy, her boots worn by much walking.
Maester, I've been asked by the Maestra to return this to you.
No, no, I insist you keep it for your trouble.
A generous offer.
She swung the chain between her fingers.
I'd best not, for that would put me in your debt in a way you might misinterpret.
Not at all. It is a mere bauble, a token of appreciation for the fine speech by the honeyed voice that so entertained me. Since she rejects me so cruelly, my sole request is that you be so kind as to exchange a few words with me, a gentle balm to my aching heart. What is your name?
Catherine, Maester. And yours?
I am Apollo Crow, a traveller. Please sit. The seamstress seated herself on an empty bench beside the rope and smiled. She was attractive, with the grace of a fighter about her long limbs and easy physical confidence. He might find a way to the other woman through this one. Jealousy and competition sometimes fired women's interest when a handsome man became involved. He called for a round of drinks and seated himself close enough to talk to the seamstress across the fence. He essayed teasing banter, but she wanted only to discuss the coming revolution.
Many speak against the radical proposal to allow women to vote. You must have a thought on this topic, Maester.
What is your opinion, Maestra? He parried.
Why, do you really wish to hear my opinion?
I'm often told I talk too much. Many men say women are formed for bread and butter and not for philosophical debate.
What do you think, Mr. Crow?
I come from a people where everyone talks a great deal, women and men equal in their vociferousness. As for what I think, I am new to this town, and thus prefer to discover what the locals may think. How else may I come to an understanding of how people get on here? Your compatriot speaks compellingly. I would wish nothing more than an evening of innocent conversation with such a persuasive voice. Perhaps in your company? He had a smile that melted women, and when he used it now, she leaned closer, and even closer still, gaze alight with interest. Over her shoulder, he noticed the honeyed voice moving toward the exit, then pulled his gaze back to the seamstress. Her lips parted as if in delight at his advances. In a low, husky, sensuous voice, she said,
"She's well guarded, Mr. Crow. Don't believe otherwise. It's best if you leave us alone."
She rose and cut her way smoothly through the crowded common room and out the door to the courtyard, through which the honeyed voice had departed. His new friends laughed.
"Well, well, you've been put in your place and lost your coin besides."
"I shall need a drink to drown my sorrow," he gestured to the server. "Fill my friends' cups again." As the youth moved forward, Apollo Crow surreptitiously tipped the bench so as to knock the server in the legs and send him sprawling. A great splash from the pitcher and a mighty shout from everyone around as they got wet distracted his male companions. In the ensuing commotion, he slipped the chain into the server's pocket, then left as quickly as possible, elbowing through the crowd to get out the door in his haste. Outside he had to pause and set an elderly man to rights who had lost hold of his cane and stumbled in the crush. Then he strode on the path of his target, who was even now slipping out the gate. As he hurried past the reeking smokehouses, a slender young man fell into step beside him. He had hair as long and black as the seamstress's, and indeed there were other signs of a family resemblance in colouring and the shape of their eyes.
"A word of advice," said the young fellow with a smile that was more a baring of teeth. "If the honeyed voice has rejected your offer, as she has, then do not press your suit."
"My thanks," replied Apollo Crow, with the sardonic eyebrow lift he had perfected as a means to intimidate people who thought to spar with him. "What business is it of yours?"
"I am her kinsman, therefore her well-being is my responsibility."
His new companion eyed him as a cat would a bird.
"Just a warning, Maester.
Personally, I find the honeyed voice bossy and impatient, but I understand that for men of your type, she presents an irresistible attraction. The need to prove that her beauty and her fierce confidence will yield to you, and you alone, where lesser men have failed. My type? What type do you believe that to be? The young man braced himself in the narrow opening of the gate, so no one, and particularly not Apollo Crowe, could pass. He sniffed the air, then frowned, just as if he could sift through the fog of the courtyard's air and tease out threads of information. Now I'm not so sure. Where did you say you come from? I didn't say. What was your name? I didn't say, said the young man, with another of those smiles filled with charm and menace. If you have family, you'll understand we look out for each other. I understand the sentiment very well. I am in every possible way a family man. The fellow kept standing there, meaning to block the gate until it was too late to follow. While Apollo Crowe was never averse to a headlong attack, he judged the other man too much of a puzzle to essay with so little to go on. There was a coiled energy about him that reminded him of himself. That sense of a body lodged in this world and a spirit anchored in the world beyond. But he had learned the hard way not to speak to strangers and ordinary people about mortal worlds and spirit worlds, because no one believed him. He had learned to turn truth into tales that people accepted as entertainment. He bowed as if in gracious retreat, acknowledging the right of family to protect its own. But upon stepping away from the gate, he at once sought out the darkest and most isolated corner of the courtyard, behind a smokehouse amid the crunch of ashy scales and discarded refuse. He paused, looking around one last time to make sure he was entirely alone. The night was not kind to his eyesight, and he could never rely on his sense of smell. Cocking his head to one side, he listened. Fiddles and stamping feet adrift in the air made it hard to pick out any softer noise. But then the young man spoke over by the gate, addressing the guards. Where did he go? I didn't see him go back into the tavern. With a sigh, he sloughed the self he wore. In a flurry of 134 pairs of wings, because it takes many crows to make a man, they flew out over the night-drenched streets in search of a woman. The flock followed the woman and the two feathered ones to a respectable inn on the waterfront, in a well-lit and prosperous district of the town. In a dense cloud, they descended onto the rooftop of the inn, as if coming to roost for the night. Individuals flapped down to spy. One even got into the common room and perched watchfully in a smoky corner as the honeyed voice sat down to supper, as drinks were sent to her table by hopeful suitors and shy admirers. A crow flew to every windowsill, looking into every room, awaiting her arrival in one of them. But it was the crow stationed at the kitchen yard who saw her leave by a back door and slip away into the night, joined by the seamstress and the young man, while the two much more conspicuous feathered ones remained behind to make it seem she hadn't left yet. A cunning scheme, indeed, to throw off the scent of people who would be following her. Cawing in excitement at this simple ruse, some of the younger crows had to be hushed, lest they draw attention. Her route took her into the humbler streets along the riverbank, where lived folk of modest circumstance and law-abiding habit. She came to rest at last in a small two-story inn with a ramshackle, windowless exterior. Despite their unprepossessing appearance, the gate and walls presented a formidable challenge for a person on the street who wanted to get a look inside without being noticed. The crows merely settled all around the roof, overlooking an interior courtyard. No fire burned in the courtyard's hearth, ashes as cold as if they hadn't been lit in days. Even this late at night, a solitary soul sat at a table, intent on reading by the illumination of a floating sphere of cool white light. Several crows hopped forward to get a better look. He was a well-dressed and well-preened man, who might be said to be as handsome as a crow, not that that was possible. When the others hurried in through the gate, he rose to greet them. By the intimate kiss he gave the seamstress, It was evident that a plan to seduce her, in order to instigate the envious attention of the honeyed voice, would probably not work. Indeed, by the way the four conversed with casual remarks and overlapping interruptions, they themselves had the manners of a flock. After a short wait, the two feathered ones appeared. Once they were inside and the gate closed, the target crossed the courtyard and entered a gated stairwell alone. The inn was really two old buildings stitched together, a set of rooms facing inward around the courtyard, and a separate wing stuck on at right angles. This extra wing protruded over the water, a relic from a now derelict ancient bridge that no longer reached the opposite shore. The repurposed bridge had no lower story, only the arched foundation, so the rooms atop were unreachable, except by the guarded stairwell and an interior passage. The windows of these rooms overlooked the river. Soon enough, a pair of shutters were opened from inside. The woman leaned out and took in a deep breath of night air, then winced at the smell of refuse and smoke. The moment she retreated into the room, two crows landed on the windowsill to watch. She lit a candle and, by its light, locked the door from the inside and tucked the key into her sleeve. Then she set the candle into a brass holder on a dressing table. Flame glimmered in the mirror as she opened a sketchbook and sat down to draw. One crow flew to a perch atop the wardrobe. Although flight and landing made no discernible noise, her hand paused. "Was there something more you needed to tell me?" she said to the air. The air offered no reply. Both the crow on the windowsill and the one on the wardrobe hopped out of sight as she closed the book and rose. After a puzzled glance around the chamber, she opened the door into the passage and went out. As soon as she shut the door, crows mobbed into the chamber. He quickly stitched himself into a single shape, all but for three parts. First, he tested the door to the passage, but she had locked it from outside. No chance escaping with the sketchbook out that way, not without the key. Taking a seat at the dressing table, he weighed the sketchbook in a hand. Too heavy to fly with, even if he created a net for crows to carry. Therefore, he reluctantly had to accept the third option, although he liked it least and would have to play for time. He tore a scrap of blank page out of the back of the book and filled it with exceedingly precise and tiny writing. This scrap he slipped into a message tube, which he fixed to the leg of one crow. Thus dismissed, it flew, and the other two parts took up watch outside. At last he opened the sketchbook. With the greatest interest and delight, he examined the first drawing, which depicted a crowned young woman riding a bull, clearly meant to be the Phoenician queen Europa, and a lion sneaking up behind them, dragging a length of chain. As a metaphor for the shrunken empire of Rome, wishing to recapture the lands it had lost hundreds of years ago, it was, if anything, a little obvious. A key tumbled the lock. He shut the book, set his elbows on the dressing table, and in the mirror examined his lean face, his glossy black hair, his nimble fingers. Was there anything wrong with him? Something he could shape better? Why was there a man in this world handsomer than he was? The hinges creaked. A figure loomed up behind him, like a stain expanding in the mirror. Candlelight glinted on the edge of a slim sword, but it wasn't as sharp as the peak of her smile. He met the reflection of her gaze and smiled in lazy reply. She had an interrogative eyebrow, not unlike his own, and she used it now. "You are sitting in my chair." "It is hard to resist admiring myself when I have the chance, for I am certainly a sleek and shiny fellow." Her gaze had a measuring look. "Indeed, it is hard to resist wondering how such a sleek and shiny fellow as you could have gotten into this locked chamber." "You are irresistible. Therefore, no barrier can keep me from you." "Really?" Her posture had the angles and muscles of someone who knew how to fight. "The passage to these rooms is guarded day and night, which, as you may imagine, is why people who have enemies like to sleep here. The door from this chamber into the passage can be locked both from the inside and from the outside, and I have the key. So common sense suggests you came in through the window. Yet the roof is too steep to negotiate, and the wall too steep to climb. Even if you could climb it, you aren't wet as you would have to be if you'd come up from the river. I might have arrived in a boat. She went to the window and looked down, then turned back to him. There's nowhere to tie it up. Do you care to explain this mystery? He rose carefully, held his hands palms out to show himself unarmed, and offered a courteous bow, hand to heart. I am not the only mystery in this chamber. The greatest mystery is your allure. You should have tried that line earlier, before your back was to the wall. Why are you here? Perhaps you and I may trade secrets. Why has the Emperor of Rome hired me? That your revolutionary agitation troubles the Roman regime is one answer, but I sense it is not the only one. I fear I am afflicted with an implacable curiosity. I could placate your curiosity by running you through with my sword. Ah, but what about your own curiosity? Do you not wish to know by what cunning and skill I appeared in your chamber? Imagine those same attributes turned solely to the task of pleasing you. Pleasing me? She considered the whole of him, a twist of amusement playing about her lips. He took the opportunity to turn his head, so she would see his best profile. With a rueful laugh, she shook her head. Before or after you turn me over to the Emperor of Rome? He considered this question with the seriousness it deserved. Before would be a sure thing. After would be determined by his whim. I can see you are a strategist, she said, a scrape like swallowed laughter in her tone that annoyed him. Was she mocking him? But what if I don't want to be kidnapped and taken to the Emperor of Rome? Perhaps you could match his price and thus dissuade me. I do not have access to the same sort of funds, or were you offering a different sort of trade? Her gaze measured him from top to toe. Naturally, you like what you see, and I certainly am formed in all ways to please you, if you like how I am formed. But I fear money is the only coin I trade in. Naturally. Anyway, you don't want to make an enemy of the Emperor of Rome, not if you are, as I'm coming to suspect, some form of hired ruffian who makes his living doing dirty work so the rich and powerful can keep their hands clean. Your peaceable acquiescence will make this all go so much more easily. I'll wait while you gather a cloak and such traveling niceties as you desire. He carefully did not pat the sketchbook, although it rested alongside his left hand. I have a ship waiting to leave within the hour. You do not. We are an hour away from low tide. No ships will be departing for some time. So that, my mysterious miscreant, was your first lie. My first lie? You've cleverly avoided a second lie, I note. I gave you several opportunities to agree that the Emperor wants to kidnap me, and you never quite did. So I think he wants something else, and I know what it is. Faster than he expected, she snatched the sketchbook from the table, leaped backward, and tapped the point of her sword to his chest. You may fight, or you may retire gracefully from the field. I'm not in a mood to hand over my sketchbook. He leaned away from the point, but thereby found himself backed up against the dressing table. This was proving much more exciting than he had hoped. So he crossed his arms and relaxed. Fearlessness in the face of blades always impressed people. Why does the Emperor of Rome want your sketchbook? What have you drawn that he feels such a desperate need to possess? Ah, that would be telling. She fished a key from her sleeve. Because I am merciful, and you have entertained me, however briefly, you may unlock the door and leave. When she tossed the key, He allowed it to strike his thigh and fall with a quiet clunk to the floor. She cocked her head with corvid-like grace, a question without words.
"Just one," he said, because he still had to stall for time.
"Just one what?"
"Show me just one page from the sketchbook, if you would be so kind. He told me what treasures it holds and why he wants it."
"No, he didn't tell you. Why do you keep lying?"
"It's a curse." His insouciant smile was one of his great gifts, a little higher on one side than the other, so that it promised both pleasure and mischief. "I always lie about something."
"And if your lie is found out, what then?"
"Curses fall in threes. Three lies caught out, or three lies uncaught."
"And then?"
He shrugged.
"How interesting. Two lies caught so far. You'd best be careful."
He was a little disturbed that she probed no further, but rather retreated to the bed, just far enough that if he lunged, she could sidestep and attempt to skewer him. She set down the sketchbook and flipped through it. He could see that the first half of the book was filled in, while the latter remained blank, pages as yet unfilled. From this angle, he could not discern what exactly she liked to draw, except dense shadows and crisp lines. At one point, she studied a two-page spread, lifted her keen gaze to him, then back down to the page.
"Oh!"
She smiled in an assessing way that puzzled him as greatly as it excited his inquisitive nature.
"That explains it."
A crow landed on the windowsill and called thrice.
"Among the Hellenes, crows are considered divine messengers," she remarked as she slapped shut the sketchbook, slid it into a pouch, and slung it over her back with every appearance of making ready to depart.
Politeness had taken him as far as he could go. He expected her to grab for the key, but instead she flung open the door of the wardrobe, jumped inside, and slammed it shut. With a leap, he grabbed the wardrobe door and tugged. It was like dragging on weighted chains. With a croak of frustration, he yanked with all his strength. The door gave way as if she had let go. He fell back, thumping into the bed, then spun a full circle to unsheath his sword out of the adamant shadows that weave together the world he was in and the spirit world he came from. Besides a set of shelves on which traveling gear was neatly folded and stacked, the wardrobe had a false back that formed a passage into the adjoining bedchamber. This chamber's door stood wide open. Her footsteps slapped as she raced down the passage. He pursued on foot, although the dim light and the low ceiling hampered his speed, and he tripped once on a loose plank. She halted at the top of the stairwell, just as the sound of clashing weapons broke out in the courtyard below. A voice shouted,
"You are all under arrest by order of the Emperor of Rome!"
Her frown fell like a sledge blow upon him.
"You led them to us! I do not call that a kindness!"
She lunged, driving him back with a series of fierce, tight thrusts that he scarcely had time to turn aside. Just as he got his bearings and turned the force of his greater height and skill against her, he bumped the back of his head on the ceiling. As he flinched, she attacked, and he skipped back to gather himself and again hit his head on a low beam. She suffered no such vicissitudes, being short and, more importantly, knowing her ground. Her blade flashed, but it was the force behind it that dismayed him. The relentless press he parried once, twice, and thrice, as his head pounded in time to the slap of her feet on the floor. Then, of course, he tripped on that cursed loose plank. He went down hard on his backside. Sucking in a sharp breath, he took hold of the threads that stitched him together, making ready to release them. He was bound by the curse to never reveal to any inhabitant of this world what he truly was, and doing so would trap him in this world forever. But to survive a killing blow, he would have to scatter. Yet no steel pierced him. She pelted back to the stairwell. By the time he picked himself up and ran after, she and the mysterious sketchbook were halfway down the steps. He plunged after, sure there must be a side gate through which she would escape, Instead, a stunning sight met his startled gaze. Despite the disparity in numbers, the Imperial soldiers had defensively backed together into an outward-facing circle. They were hampered by a lack of light, for none of the lanterns they carried flickered with even the weakest flame. Only a cold white sphere of light drifted above the head of the particularly handsome man, who stood over to one side away from the altercation, leaning against a wall with his arms crossed, like he was annoyed that his reading had been so rudely interrupted. Round and around the soldiers prowled the two feathered ones, with their claws and teeth and height and speed proving a formidable barrier. One of the soldiers made a probing stab, only to have a claw slash the sword right out of his grip. It clattered away onto the pavement. As the soldier leaped boldly forward to retrieve it, the young man Apollo Crowe had met at the tavern gate bolted out of the shadows. He melted in a smear and twist of shadow and became a large black saber-toothed cat. Apollo Crowe stared, almost losing control of himself, as a shock of recognition pulsed through him. Here was another creature like himself, a denizen of the spirit world, who, like all the inhabitants of the spirit world, had the capacity and necessity to change. The huge cat roared into the soldier's startled face. The man staggered back to the safety of his soldierly flock, drawing a knife. By now, all were quaking. The honeyed voice marched forward to confront the hapless men. She looked very powerful with her flock around her.
"Throw down your swords, and you may go in peace, my friends. You labor for a power that will happily sacrifice you for its own selfish purposes."
"What strengthens Rome, strengthens us all," said one of the soldiers stoutly.
Her back was to Apollo Crowe, and the bag slung there invitingly, gaping open, as he crept on soft feet forward. She kept talking, perhaps a little too accustomed to hearing herself speak.
"They who rule give you just enough rope that you feel you can walk freely, while they keep all the advantage to themselves. They pay you a pittance, while they sit on a vast treasury."
He slid the sketchbook out of the bag and took a step back.
"They allow you to till the land as long as you pay a tithe to them for the honor."
A flutter of air disturbed his senses, for he was adept at adapting to any slight change in the loft and direction of the winds. The currents of movement suggested something moving alongside him, and yet he saw no one. Not until the seamstress appeared as out of the air itself. Her edged blade pressed across his chest.
"Stop there," she said.
Apollo Crowe laughed out of sheer surprise. Her sudden materialization, where she had not been before, caused the poor soldiers to lose their tenuous hold on courage. As one, they bolted for the street. The feathered one stood politely aside to let them pass. The big cat chased them to the gate and lashed its tail with vigor.
"What manner of creature are you?" he asked the seamstress. "I might ask the same of you," she said. "For you are wrapped in many threads, a skein of shadows, but I don't know what it means."
"Those are the threads of a curse laid on me when I was exiled from my home."
"How interesting," said the seamstress, looking as delighted as a child settling in for a thrilling tale. "Why were you exiled?"
"I took back something that belonged to me, but it was deemed theft by those with more power than me. So I was cursed into exile on the charge of being a thief." The honeyed voice turned to meet his gaze, her attention as bold and solid as truth. Just for an instant, it seemed that within her eyes he glimpsed a vast and silent vision of shapes and colors tumbling like flashes of light and line.
"That is the most honest thing I've heard you say," she began,
but broke off as a crow fluttered down to land on his shoulder. The big cat hissed. The seamstress vanished, like a thread pulled out of the fabric of the world. The Emperor of Rome and a company of Imperial soldiers marched through the gate, their ranks bristling with spears, swords, and crossbows. The cat retreated, teeth bared. The feathered ones lifted their crests threateningly, while the well-dressed and unfortunately handsome man remained standing quietly in the shadows, easy to overlook. The honeyed voice faced down the Emperor, with the look of a person sure that her confederates will back her up, that as a flock they are stronger together than alone. As much as this may come as a surprise to you, I confess I did not expect to meet you in Nicaea, she remarked, as if she and the Emperor were well acquainted and accustomed to sparring.
Foment revolution among the principalities if you must, my dear Beatrice.
His avuncular tone made her lips pinch. The turmoil you and your associates create among the border lords serves me well enough.
You mean to expand the empire to its old borders? You will start by moving your troops into areas where you think the ruling princes are too weak to resist, or will be grateful for imperial protection against radical agitators.
Do you say that with certainty, or is it a guess?
What do you think?
I think I do not intend to share my plans with you. When you bring your radical ideas into my empire, then you become my business.
Is it your intention to arrest me?
The Emperor of Rome looked past her.
Do you have it?
Apollo Crow tucked the sketchbook under his arm.
Yes.
One luxuriant eyebrow the honeyed voice raised, and her lips quirked in a silent laugh. There came a pause, a sort of expectant silence, a drawing in as of breath. The Emperor of Rome suddenly caught sight of the man standing almost hidden at the wall.
Archers! Kill him!
Your mistake,
uttered the honeyed voice. Crossbows raised, the archers targeted the man just as the temperature in the courtyard plunged from a summery balm to an eye-stinging freeze. The cold hit like a hammer, slamming the Emperor and his troops to the ground. The magic hit so hard, like an invisible downward slap, that Apollo Crow almost came undone. He held himself together by sheer will, kneeling on the ground as his thoughts swirled. In his time in this world, he had encountered magic rarely. He stayed away from mages as a wise bird avoids sunning itself on a rock beside snakes. They might not wish to harm him, but it was better not to find out. By the time the Emperor and his soldiers picked themselves up from the ground, the honeyed voice and her associates had fled into the darkened streets. The soldiers turned toward the gate, then paused, awaiting orders.
Let me see, said the Emperor, extending a hand.
Apollo Crow handed him the sketchbook. A soldier lit a lamp, and by its light, the Emperor flipped through the pages, at first with a self-congratulatory smile, then with an increasingly furrowed frown.
This isn't her sketchbook,
he roared, and flung the book so abruptly at Apollo Crow that he didn't have time to dodge. It thumped against his chest and thudded to the ground in a crush of paper.
Curse it!
Shouted the Emperor. Then,
go after them! Search the premises! And arrest this useless thief!
Apollo Crow hastily picked up the sketchbook, but since he was immediately surrounded by bristling spears and angry soldiers, who acted as if this was all his fault, he had no chance to look at it. The puzzling question of what he had stolen and why it wasn't the right thing nipped at his heels, all the long march to Castle Hill and down ill-lit steps to a corridor of prison cells dug into the rock. Rough hands shoved him into a narrow chamber, then slammed shut the door, leaving him alone with the smell of old urine. High up, right against the ceiling, some manner of opening allowed in a breath of salty sea air. It was too dark to see anything, so he groped around until he found a cot. There he sat. Not long after, light gleamed beneath the cell door, amid the drum of footsteps and the jangle of keys. The door clanged open, and he hastily got to his feet as two soldiers entered, carrying lamps. The Emperor appeared.
You shouldn't promise what you can't deliver,
said the great man without preamble. Apollo Crow let the book fall open into the glow of lamplight. A blank page greeted him, and another, all blank.
she substituted this unused one for the other one.
They played you.
The Emperor shook his head, jaw set with anger.
And to think I actually believed you could manage what you promised.
From your description, I thought there was only the woman involved, a persuasive speaker hiding secrets from you in her journal. I thought she'd be accompanied by a few fellow radicals and malcontents. I didn't realize her comrades would be two feathered ones, a shape-changing saber-toothed cat, a woman who can vanish at will, and a powerful mage. Had you warned me, I would have changed my strategy.
So you say, now that you failed.
The Emperor walked to the door and, pausing at the threshold, spoke to the guards.
Keep her locked in here until I return.
Her? Said Apollo Crow. After a generous pause, like an actor deciding whether to give the final flourish to a bow the audience is anticipating, the Emperor turned back.
I have my own spies. You are, in fact, Apollonia Crow, a notorious lady thief and smuggler, whose last known residence was the Illyrian city of Salona.
The Emperor eyed the fine, glossy black garments Crow wore, then gave a grimace of disgust.
There is a simple way to reveal the truth about you, but I disdain violent and humiliating methods.
But you are an emperor. Empires are always violent.
Empires bring peace and order and justice when an enlightened person rules.
If that enlightened person is you,
the sparring is pointless. What I know is that when it suits your purpose, you use a male disguise, as now.
In this world, I find my path is better smoothed when people believe I am a man.
So you admit I have seen through your lie?
Crow offered a polite bow and tried very hard not to make it mocking, although he wanted to laugh out loud.
I disguised myself as a man when I am really a woman. Allow me to introduce myself properly, Your Excellency. I am Apollonia Crow, espionage agent and recoverer of stolen objects, at your service.
You are a thief and a swindler. You'll serve a year in Nikaya's prison for your crime. He stepped out into the passage, followed by the guards. To his back, Apollo Crow remarked,
Three lies uncaught.
What? Said the Emperor impatiently over his shoulder. The curse forces me to accept any offer of employment made to me, and compels me to finish the work to my employer's satisfaction, whatever I may think of the job. But three lies uncaught allow me to walk away from the contract, as long as I tell the truth about the curse to the employer I'm leaving, as I am leaving you now.
I've heard enough of this farrago. Close the door!
The cell door slammed shut. Bars dropped into place. Locks clicked. The sound of footsteps receded. Apollo Crow tossed the blank sketchbook on the cot and waited a little longer to make sure everyone had gone back to their expected routine. Then he unstitched the threads that held him together and became a murder of crows. 134 pair of wings. Each crow easily fit through the barred slit, built to be too narrow to admit a human body. Most of the flock flew down to the harbor and roosted in the masts until the crack of dawn as ships began to sail with the tide. Although they circled in their numbers, they saw no sign of the honeyed voice or her confederates on any deck escaping by sea. At length, two of the farthest-flung scouts returned with news of a coach fleeing west on the coastal road. By the time the flock caught up with the coach, the vehicle had crossed out of Roman territory and into the bordering nation of Oyo, beyond reach of any but the most foolhardy of imperial soldiers. Crows are perfect scouts. They accompanied the travelers all day without being spotted. At dusk, the coachman and groom put into a well-guarded inn. Soon after, the woman opened the shutters to an upstairs room. She sat down at a small table, opened her sketchbook, and began to draw.
Apollonia Crow took shape in the carriage house and thus avoided the guards at the gate. Climbing the back steps, she knocked on the appropriate door and, when it was opened, stepped inside with a charming smile.
"You," said the honeyed voice. "You recognize me? You're very striking. What are you doing here? And why, Mr. Crow, have you affected this disguise as a woman? Did you think to confuse me with a fashionable gown and your hair styled in the antique Hellene fashion?"
Apollonia Crow paused to look at her reflection in the dressing table mirror. Her black hair fell in pleasing ringlets past her shoulders, but perhaps her chin was a little too square for this face. What a wonder it always was to know that a mere change of clothing and outward presentation altered so radically how people responded to you, whether they thought you too manly for beauty or too feminine for handsomeness. "The Emperor discovered my ruse." Apollonia Crow's gaze slid toward the sketchbook. The woman closed it and sat on it.
"Your ruse? What ruse is that?" "That I disguised myself as a man when really I am a woman."
She tilted her head to one side, examining him as if to untangle the threads of his being.
"No, you aren't."
"I'm not." The honeyed voice seated herself prettily at the table, opened the sketchbook, and resumed her drawing with a speed and precision that made the images emerge as if by magic, although it was merely skill. Crows and yet more crows flowed out of her pencil and across the page, flocking, roosting, arguing, spying. They were handsome crows, too, not a single ugly caricature among them.
"Do you know, I was once infatuated with the Emperor of Rome, before he became emperor. I offered to marry him, even though he is old enough to be my father, and yet he turned me down, even though he wanted my dreaming for his own uses. How strange that he rejected such a facile way to gain my undying loyalty."
"I should think it puzzling he did not choose you as his life mate when he had the chance." She pressed a hand against her bosom and fluttered her beguiling eyes.
"Do you think so?"
"Yes, of course. You are loquacious and intelligent."
"Why, you flatter me."
"Why would I need to flatter you when you are already so fine a figure? Almost as fine as me."
"Why, indeed?"
she said with a laugh.
"Alas that he had scruples and was loath to take advantage of my infatuation in that particular way. Yet it was a fortunate escape on my part, for otherwise I might be a very different person with a very different outlook on the world than I am now. Rather than calling for revolution, I would be standing among those trying to stamp it out. An irony, do you not think? What are your dreams to him?"
She set down her pencil.
"I can see the future, in a manner of speaking. My dreams give me glimpses of what is to come. Often I cannot interpret the visions, because they appear as details without context. A hat, a flowering branch, a broken tea set. So I draw the visions I see in my dreams in my sketchbook. If their details and context can be properly untangled, which is no simple task, my drawings may be said to predict the future."
"A lion, that would be the Emperor, chaining Queen Europa."
"Ha! That was no dream. That was just a metaphorical sketch."
She tapped the pencil against the page.
"For example, last week I dreamed of crows. 134 crows. Isn't that an unusual number?"
For once, Crow had no answer.
"Crows are messengers. Of all creatures, they can pass most easily from the spirit world to this world. If a saber-toothed cat can become a man, then why not a flock of crows become a man, or a woman for that matter? Since a flock contains both male and female crows, why be limited to one or the other?"
Almost the crows fell apart, so shocked by how casually the honeyed voice dropped the truth upon them.
"What brought you across from the spirit world to bide in this world?"
"None of your business."
The words came out more of a harsh core.
But you already told us, didn't you? You just thought we wouldn't believe you, that we'd think you were telling a tale. What did you steal?
I stole back part of myself, Crow snapped. Two of my number, stolen by a power greater than mine to serve his needs, as kings and emperors do. That is why I was punished and exiled to this world, cursed to serve anyone who offered to pay me, as if I am nothing more than a petty mercenary. And here you have landed. Are you back to make another attempt on my sketchbook? No, I am no longer obligated to serve the Emperor of Rome. Now I have come to make an offer to you. To me? You caught me in three lies. Therefore, I must henceforth always tell you the truth.
She frowned consideringly and made no retort.
You told me earlier that you are low on funds. We are not as well funded as we'd like to be. It's true. Revolution is an expensive business. Often we spend what funds we have on charitable work. Also, we have an exceedingly large household to feed. None of this is a secret. Why do you care? I don't like powerful people who punish me, which means, to start with, that I don't like the Emperor of Rome. Crows hold grudges. You can help me. How is that? A woman who can catch glimpses of the future, a vanishing seamstress, a saber-toothed cat, two fearsome feathered ones, and an annoyingly handsome mage. I've had the chance to take a good look around the imperial compound in Rome. I know where an extensive treasury is kept. With the right flock, we can steal it.
Dark eyes flashed up to meet Crow's gaze in the mirror. The honeyed voice smiled in a gratified and appreciative way that jolted all 134 crow hearts.
When do we start?
Walter John Williams. In the fast-paced story that follows, a dashing and adventurous young man sets out in hot pursuit of a miscreant, only to find that sometimes it's perhaps better to leave well enough alone. Walter John Williams was born in Minnesota and now lives near Albuquerque, New Mexico. His short fiction has appeared frequently in Asimov's Science Fiction, as well as in The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Wheel of Fortune, Global Dispatches, Alternate Outlaws, and in other markets, and has been gathered in the collections Facets and Frankensteins and Foreign Devils. His novels include Ambassador of Progress, Night Moves, Hardwired, The Crown Jewels, Voice of the Whirlwind, House of Shards, Days of Atonement, Aristoi, Metropolitan, City on Fire, a huge disaster thriller, The Rift, and a Star Wars novel, Destiny's Way, and the half-dozen installments of his acclaimed modern space opera epic, Dread Empire's Fall, which begins with The Praxis. Among his recent books are the novels Implied Spaces, This Is Not a Game, Deep State, and The Fourth Wall, the chapbook novella, The Boolean Gate, and a new collection, The Green Leopard Plague and Other Stories. His most recent book is a new novel in the Praxis series, Impersonations. He won a long overdue Nebula Award in 2001 for his story Daddy's World, and took another Nebula in 2005 with his story The Green Leopard Plague. The adventurer Quillifer, who narrates the following story, is the hero of his own series, the first installment of which, Quillifer, appears from Saga Books in November 2017.
The Triumph of Virtue by Walter John Williams. Is it a very great fault, do you think, for a prominent person to display a married lover to the world? Before friends, relatives, the in-laws, the lover's unhappy spouse? Is it a lesser fault if the prominent person is the monarch? For it was none other than our new Queen Balloda, who had fallen in love with the married Viscount Broughton of Hartness, and who I could now view together with him in the swan boat the latter had built for her, a boat covered with thousands of actual swan feathers that trembled in the breeze like sea foam. In the boat was room for no more than two passengers. The couple were together beneath the canopy in the back, their heads together, as 12 oarsmen in Broughton livery rowed them about the Lake of Kingsmere. The Viscount was a pretty young man, it is true, blonde like the Queen, and with a face as lively as hers was impassive. Dressed in the satin and silk of court finery, gems winking from their fingers and from the great collars of lace that draped over their shoulders, they made a resplendent couple. During the early days of Balodda's reign, with her royal father dead on a distant shore and her scheming half-brother Claiborne plotting for the throne, Broughton had ridden into the capital of Selford with a troop of companions to declare their allegiance and pledge their swords to her service. She appointed him Master of the Hunt, and now he played host to the Queen at her own hunting lodge. The Viscount's poor, neglected wife was nowhere in sight. She had declared that she did not like boats, and so had retired to the Kingsmere Lodge to nurse a headache, and very possibly a broken heart. But how great a fault lay in our royal Balodda. Her much-married father, the late King Stillwell, had often sought the wives and daughters of his noble companions, and few had dared to object. A great king, it was supposed, possessed appetites as vast as his majesty, and was not bound by the laws that constrained the Mayony. Why should a queen be so bound, merely on account of her sex? These complexities were not abstract to me, for I too had a married lover. Though, as I was an 18-year-old lawyer's apprentice, and not a monarch, I did not dare parade Amelie in front of the court. She paraded proudly, but alone, walking languorously along the verge of the lake with her fan dangling from her wrist. And since our arrival at Balodda's hunting lodge 2 days before, I'd had no opportunity to speak with her, let alone speak privately. Yet I was constantly alert to her presence, a kind of tremor in the atmosphere of which I was subtly aware, as if she were radiating some sort of invisible beam that prickled over my skin. She was always present, yet always unavailable. I was impatient and filled to the eyebrows with frustration, and it was with great relief that I saw her leave the lawn and stroll into one of the lodge's formal gardens. With a feigned casualness, I followed. The garden was symmetrically laid out, square in area, and at its centre stood a worn statue of an old man, or a venerable god, so eroded that he seemed all gaping black eyes and hollowed-out beard. The flowers were brown and dead, and the avenues lined with autumn leaves that crackled beneath my boots. I affected to be surprised by the presence of a fair lady in this place, and I took off my cap and louted low, as the saying is. A cool breeze floated past, and autumn leaves rained down from the trees and skittered along the gravel walks. "Goodman Quillifer," she said, "do you come to view dead flowers?" "I come to view something far more beautiful," said I, "more lovely than all the brilliant autumn leaves, more perfect than Bernaldi's statue of the Graces, finer than—" "Ah," she said, "you come to see Viscount Broughton of Hartness. He is not here, but you will find him on the lake." I straightened and put on my cap. "I have viewed him. That fair face charmed me not." A wry smile touched her lips. "It charms the only person that matters." I contemplated my lover, Amelie Brilliana Trevel, the seventh child and fifth daughter of the Count of Coulm. Such was the abundance of daughters in his gloomy northern stronghold that Coulm rather haphazardly gave Amelie in marriage to his friend, the widowed Marquis of Steyne, for the express purpose of breeding an heir. Married at 16, Amelie was now 17 and had been carrying the heir for 5 months. the nausea gravidarum having passed and her husband having ridden off on a military adventure that got him captured and held for ransom, I had been fortunate to find Emily ready for her own adventure. I was only a few months older than she and had been recently orphaned, a misfortune which, as a result of a fluke of patronage, had resulted in my being presented at court. Yet I held no office and had but little money and possessed nothing in abundance but time. Time which I was willing to devote to Amelie. As Amelie was with child, she had dispensed with the corsets and farthingales and bum rolls of feminine fashion and wore a garment of black velvet, very like a dressing gown, but held closed with swags and braid and silver gilt buttons arrayed in artful disorder on its front. Its sleeves were puffed and purfled, its hem embroidered with gold thread and cat's eye chrysoberyls. Pearls wound their way through Amelie's tawny hair, and a carcanet of jet beads and diamonds held her long throat in a close embrace. A fan of black swan feathers hung carelessly from one hand. She gazed at me with long, lazy dark eyes that made her seem as if she had just risen from a lengthy, luxurious sleep. She walked past me with slow, languorous steps. I restrained my desire to put my arms around her and instead followed just behind her left shoulder. Amelie looked at me over that velvet-clad shoulder. She still wore that amused smile. The Queen's mother is beside herself with fury. She planned a greater husband for Balodda than a little penniless Viscount. I can't imagine any Viscount being penniless, said I. At one point in my life, I had actually been penniless and did not recall sharing my status with nobles. He is a pauper indeed compared to foreign princes, said Amelie. The King of Varcellos has sons to spare and offers them to Balodda severally or altogether, according to her taste. And the King of Loreto has but only one prince, though he is the heir, and the suitor the Queen Mother most favours. Loreto, I said. Leonora favours Loreto? Have we not fought a score of wars with that kingdom? Are they not our great enemies? In the event of marriage, said she, they would not be our enemies, but our loving kin. Then, said I, the Queen Mother greatly underestimates the sorts of quarrels that can arise in families. Amelie turned to me and touched her chin with the tip of her closed fan. Did you hunt this morning? I had, in fact, pursued stag through Her Majesty's deer park. I am not a natural horseman, and I was happy to ride toward the back of the pack. When I could not avoid a jump, my courser took me over it, rather than the other way around, and in the end I was pleased not to have pursued deer, but to have avoided a broken neck. I did well enough, I looked at her, yet I hope some other manner of hunting will prove more lucky for me. She looked at me from her long eyes. What manner is that? I hope to track you to your den, my lady. She flashed her little chisel-shaped white teeth, a feature that in a lesser person might have been a defect, but which in Amelie I found enchanting. I would bite you if you did, said she. She let fall her fan. But your hunt would fail. The guest rooms are crowded, and I share a room with my two maids. We would not be alone. I fell into step with her. It is a fine day, I said, and perhaps we might find a mossy nook in the forest. Too many eyes, she said. Tonight, then, after the play? I paused by the corroded old statue and turned to face her. We could meet here. I could bring blankets and a flask with a warming libation. She smiled and touched my arm with her fan. I will not say no, but I can make no promises. Other people came into the garden then, and Amelie and I parted. I procured blankets and a flask of brandy, which I rolled up and hid beneath a bench in a shadowed part of the garden. Then I returned to the lake. More boats had joined Broughton's swan boat on the surface of the water, and there was a barge with music where the tenor Castagnato sang, surrounded by a group of girl children dressed as water nymphs. Ballotta's mother, the dowager, Queen Leonora, sped about the lake in her own little galley and kept a stony eye on her daughter. That night, we supped out of doors, this time by torchlight, a great venison feast that had been cooking all afternoon. There were dishes of roast venison, venison stewed with vegetables and herbs, venison breaded and fried, venison backstrap wrapped in bacon and broiled. Alongside were sweet sauces composed of cherry and apricot, plum and raspberry. Venison pie was presented at the high table with pastry sculptures of hearts and does. Several varieties were offered, each of venison soup, venison patties, and venison sausage. There were kidneys seared or deviled along with the liver, or fried and doused with sherry and mustard. The deer hearts were cut up, marinated in sweet vinegar, fried, and served on greens. The liver was fried with butter, bacon, parsley, onions, and rosemary, or mixed with venison to make the large meatballs called faggots. The tongue was roasted and served sliced thin on salad, or braised and served on simnel bread with gravy. With the venison was served the traditional frumenty, done in a dozen different ways, both sweet and savory. I supped vastly. Then we went to the outdoor theatre and watched my Lord Roundsilver's company perform The Triumph of Virtue, a masque written by the poet Blackwell. Few of the company's actors were involved, for most of the parts in the masque that did not involve singing were taken by members of the court, all dressed in extravagant costumes that no acting company could possibly afford. The story was an allegory, which made it tedious, and involved the singer Castagnato as the demon Iniquity, who was rejoicing in the fact that he'd succeeded in capturing and imprisoning Virtue and her friends, Honor, Purity, and Piety. Whatever dungeon he'd put them in, it was a place with a lot of music and dancing. My eyes turned to the great throne-like chairs where sat the Queen and her party. Her favourite, Broughton, was on her right, and the two leaned toward each other and shared smiles and glances. On the left was her mother, Leonora, who looked from the play to her daughter and back, thwarted fury glittering in her eyes. Near them were the ambassadors of Varcellos and Loreto, faces set in attitudes of thoughtful calculation. Of Lady Broughton, there was naught to be seen. I wondered if Virtue, Honour, Purity, and Piety were in truth held in captivity somewhere, while this royal tableau played itself out, and the court sang and danced and knew better than to break the virtues out of prison. I turned to view my lover Amelie, the Marchioness of Steyne, and saw her half reclined in a large chair, her fine long eyes half closed in languor, the pearls in her hair gleaming softly in the torchlight. At that moment I felt perhaps a little sympathy for the demon Iniquity, his fine voice and his lovely, seductive songs. Virtue and her comrades eventually broke free, and the company celebrated with a galliard. I applauded with the rest and hastened through the cold wind to my lodgings for my old tweed overcoat, which I brought with me to the garden, where I retrieved my bundle and waited for Amelie. I stood in the lee of the wind by the old statue and watched high clouds scud across the stars, and when the wind blew cold up my neck, I reached for the bottle of brandy and took a swallow of its fire. A spatter of rain came down, and another spatter. Then the heavens opened and black rain pelted down. I realized that Amelie would not come and ran for the lodge. By morning, the wind had strengthened and freezing rain was slashing down. The lake was so turned to froth that it looked like milk, and the Queen's swan boat pitched at its mooring while the wind tore at its feathers. The lodge was filled with hunters unable to hunt, and their mood was sour and irritable. Some played at cards for more money than I could afford, and others played chess. The Queen was not in view, for she was closeted with her spiritual advisers for a round of chants and prayers. Her favourite, Broughton, must have been praying alongside her, for he was not present either. I watched a few games of chess, but I found myself frustrated in the same way that I had been when I'd first learned the game. The board presented a rigid field of 64 squares, and the pieces manoeuvred about in ways that were inflexible. A knight had to move a certain way, and the abbot another, and the king a third. Yet I had never understood why any of this was necessary. Why should not a queen move like a knight, or a cunning abbot dissolve the boundaries between its white square and the black square adjacent, and so occupy it? Wherefore should not a mighty king move with the same range and power as the queen? And, for that matter, why should only one piece move at a time? A proper king should be able to marshal his forces and move his whole army at once, to the thunder of drums and the clangor of trumpets. It seemed to me that chess did not represent the world as I understood it, or at any rate as I wished it to be. Were I a pawn on that board, I would have slipped away from that confining arrangement of 64 squares, taken advantage of cover available on the tabletop, a cup here, a candlestick there, to march unobserved behind the enemy and from there launch a surprise attack to capture a castle or stab the enemy king. But alas, the pieces are confined to their roles, and pawns may not leave the board unless captured, and once captured, they may not escape. I could not help but feel that all the pieces lacked proper imagination. Chess is a game I could much improve, if only given the opportunity. While the chess games went on, the wind died down, and the rain decreased to a misty drizzle. Some of the guests began to talk hopefully of going out to shoot some rabbits. I grew tired of watching lords play chess badly, and walked through a series of drawing rooms toward another room, where I had seen a table of skittles. So involved were my musings on chess that it took me a few seconds to react to the shrieks of women. I spun toward the sound, and a door banged open right in front of me. A tall cavalier, hat and long coat starry with rain, burst out of the door and ran into me as he dashed through the room. I felt a savage impact on my shoulder, and the breath went out of me in a great rush. I had just turned and was unbalanced even before the stranger struck me, and the blow knocked me sprawling. The shrieks continued, accompanied now by the clank of the cavalier's roweled spurs, and the uproar scraped my nerves as I strove to still my whirling mind. I got my feet under me and stood, and as I staggered toward the screams, I groped at myself to find if the stranger had stabbed me. I reeled through the open door and found myself in a withdrawing room, full of ladies. The Viscountess Broughton sat on the carpet clutching at her abdomen with both hands, and everyone else was frozen in postures of surprise and horror. Only a few seconds had passed since I first heard the screams. I knelt by the stricken noblewoman and touched her cold, pale hands. "Are you all right, my lady?" She looked at me with wide eyes.
"He stabbed me,"
she said. I gently parted her hands. I saw no blood, no deadly gash in the daffodil yellow silk of her gown. I looked then at her lap and saw the blackened steel of a dagger blade lying in the folds of her skirt. I plucked it forth and saw that it had broken near the hilt. "I think you may be unwounded, madame," I said. She gasped and searched her gown, finding only a small tear over her abdomen. Tears spilled from her eyes.
"My busk," she said. "I'm wearing a steel busk."
At this point, other men arrived, demanding to know what had happened, and more kept arriving over the next few minutes, and everything kept having to be explained all over again. They were all members of the nobility, and all wanted to be in charge. One of them snatched the knife blade away, and I never got it back. Then someone called out,
"Hue and cry!"
And half the gentlemen ran from the room. The words,
"Hue and cry!"
were then shouted out all over the lodge, pointlessly, because a hue and cry was supposed to be raised when the criminal was in sight, to keep him from escaping, and the cavalier had not been in sight since he vanished from the parlour with spurs clanking, and not one of the pursuers knew what he looked like. Then more cries rose,
"Guard the Queen!"
And more men ran off to form a wall around the monarch. Lady Broughton ignored all the questions hurled at her and continued to weep, slow tears dropping steadily from her eyes. The floral aroma of a cordial floated through the air, and I looked to see Amelie offering a delicate crystal cup. I had not noticed her in the room till that moment. "I think perhaps Lady Broughton needs a restorative," she said. I passed the glass to Lady Broughton, and she drank. This action seemed to bring her a little more into an awareness of her situation, and she looked around at the circle of ladies. "Who was he? Does anyone know him?" No one seemed to have recognized him, and they all began to discourse at length concerning how little they knew. "Perhaps we could shift Lady Broughton to a couch," suggested one lady, and they all agreed. The ladies clustered around the stricken woman. Neither I nor any other man was permitted to assist, and they helped her to rise and placed her on a couch, while they arranged satin cushions beneath her back. Being useless, I let my attention wander over the scene, and I saw the hilt of the dagger lying on the floor near the door. I bent to retrieve it. It was what is called a sword-hilt dagger, as the hilt resembles the cross-hilt of a sword with a disc-shaped pommel. The blade had snapped off about an inch below the hilt, leaving the smith's hallmark visible where it was stamped on the blade, a triangular shield holding an imperial crown. The pommel was made of red jasper and was carved in a strange design, an arm with a wing where the shoulder should be, and carrying a mace with a tip that resembled a crown. I tried to read it as a rebus. Wing, arm, mace, crown. Mace, crown, arm, feathers. Flying, arm, club. Clearly I was misreading the message, whatever it was. I was still puzzling over this when a compact yellow-haired man arrived, wearing that very design embroidered into his doublet. Viscount Broughton of Hartness, the husband of the victim and the Queen's lover. As soon as he came into the room, all conversation ceased. He approached his wife, hesitated a moment, then took her hand. If there were affection or concern in his heart, it did not show on his face. Instead, he was very pale and was no doubt considering what this would mean regarding his relationship with the Queen. His wife's life had been spared because she was wearing her corset, as did all well-bred ladies of fashion. The busk, usually a piece of wood or bone, was a wedge-shaped stiffener worn at the front of the corset and intended to flatten the bosom to conform to the dictates of current fashion. I do not know why fashion insisted that women alter their natural shapes in order to display chests as flat as those of young boys, but fashion saved Lady Broughton's life that morning, as did the fact that she could afford a high-quality steel busk, which, being more flexible than wood, was more comfortable. We were all pretending not to watch Lord and Lady Broughton when a sergeant of the yeoman archers arrived, carrying a half-pike so as to skewer any available traitors. He demanded information, which was given by all the ladies at once. No sooner had he sorted all this out than his lieutenant appeared, his hand on the hilt of his sword, and he had to sort through the clamour all over again. The lieutenant was just beginning to make sense of this when his captain arrived, and it all had to be gone through once more. "Her Majesty is safe," the captain wanted to reassure everyone on that point. "The house is being searched, and the ruffian will be found." "He came in from out of doors," I said. "His hat and coat were wet from the rain," I pointed. "He ran that way, probably to flee the lodge." The captain looked at the lieutenant, who looked at the sergeant. "That next room leads outside, aye," he said. "We make sure the door is locked on our nightly patrols." I handed the captain the hilt of the broken dagger. "This is the knife that broke," I said. "I know not where the blade has gone. Someone took it." The captain examined the dagger, saw the device on the red jasper pommel, and looked up at Broughton in cold surmise. He seemed about to say something, then decided against it. He turned and left the room, followed by the other yeoman archers, and he followed the assassin through into the next room with its skittle tables. I followed the gang of archers along with some of the remaining gentlemen. It seemed the excitement in Lady Broughton's room was over. A sturdy oaken door led from the room to the grounds outside. The rain had died down to a soft mist that caressed my face with cool fingers. The air smelled of broken, beaten vegetation. A wide gravel drive circled around the house, and on the far side was a garden. A stooped gardener in big boots, cloak and hat, was attempting to repair storm damage to the garden.
"You there!" called the captain. "Did you see anyone leave by this door?"
Raindrops slid from the sagging brim of his hat as the gardener straightened. He was an old man, with a long beard that stretched out over his chest in wet, serpentine fingers.
"Aye, sir," he said. "He asked me to hold his horse."
The captain quickly ascertained that the man had ridden up, paid the gardener a crown to hold his horse, and then gone into the lodge. A few minutes later, he'd come out, mounted his horse, and trotted away in the direction of the gate.
"We must pursue him, sir," said the lieutenant stoutly. "Hue and cry," said one of the gentlemen.
"Not just yet." The captain turned to the gardener. "What kind of horse did the fellow ride?"
"A chestnut, sir."
The captain turned to his lieutenant. "Choose a party to ride in pursuit. Good riders, good horses. We should only need a half dozen or so. I will report to Her Majesty."
"Hue and cry!"
shouted the gentleman again, and they all rushed off. I looked down the gravel drive in the direction the cavalier had fled. The pursuers would ride 2 leagues through the forest to the main gate, then have to decide whether the cavalier had turned right to the capital of Selford or to the left for Black Sykes and the north. That was assuming the cavalier took the road at all, instead of riding off through the Queen's Forest to some hidden destination of his own. I approached the gardener. "Father," said I, "you say the horse was a chestnut?"
"Yes, sir."
He leaned on his rake.
"What they call a liver chestnut. Very dark. More brown than red."
"Did you get a good look at him?"
"Nay, sir. His collar was up, and he wore his hat pulled low over his face. I think he may have had a beard, sir."
"A beard he shared with most of the men in the kingdom. Did you mark his voice, father? Where he might have come from?"
"He talked somewhat like they of Barnhill," said the gardener, "like most of them at the big house."
Indeed, most of those at court tended to soften their consonants in the style of Barnhill, whether they were born there or not.
"And the tack?"
"Finely made, sir. A saddle such as they use here for the chase. Brown leather. There were steel roundels on the breast collar. Medallions-like, for decoration."
"Of any particular pattern?"
"They had like rays on them, sir."
"Any other ornaments on the saddle?"
"Nay, I can think of none." "The leather was not tooled or ornamented?"
"Nay, it was plain, but well made and nearly new. Brown leather, as I said."
"The bridle likewise?"
"Aye."
I supposed I could continue to ask about the girth and the stirrups and the bit, but I was already feeling this line of inquiry was hopeless. And then I remembered the crown and shield hallmark on the broken dagger, and I felt a flush of icy water flood my veins and shock me into sudden alertness. "Was there a mark on the saddle? A hallmark stamped on the saddle by a marker?" The old man's eyes brightened.
"Oy, sir, there was the figure of a bird stamped on the flap near the rider's left knee. I noticed it when I helped his foot into the stirrup."
"A hawk? Eagle?"
"Nay, sir, a small bird. A sparrow, maybe, or warbler, or some such."
I gave the gardener a silver crown.
"Thank you, father. That is very useful."
He touched the brim of his hat.
"I'm very grateful, sir. It's a proper gentleman you are."
I grinned at him.
"I'm no gentleman at all."
I returned to the lodge. A pair of yeoman archers stood guard outside the withdrawing room, where Lady Broughton was undergoing an examination by the royal physician. Broughton leaned on the wall of the next room, pensive eyes fixed on the floorboards, his heel kicking idly at the wainscoting. I returned to the parlour, where cards were scattered on the tables and chessmen stood abandoned in their ranks and files. Events had overleaped the boundaries of the game, and only a piece that had already left the board could possibly be of use. Small groups of people clustered together and spoke in low voices. I saw Emily with some of her friends by the fireplace, and I walked to join them, standing politely and waiting my turn to speak. Two gentlemen dashed into the room, booted, cloaked, and spurred on the way to the stables. They paused long enough for a cup of wine apiece, then continued on their way. One of Emily's friends looked at me.
"You are not joining the pursuit?"
"My horse is a stout animal," said I, "but not a racer," which referred not so much to the horse, but to myself. I turned to Emily. "Lady Broughton is no worse." She pulled her green satin gown close about her.
"It was a dreadful shock," said she.
"I cannot speak to the state of her mind, but I think her body is unharmed."
"I do not understand how Broughton can survive this," someone said. "He will be accused of trying to make away with his wife in order to marry the Queen."
"The attempt failed," said one of the gentlemen.
"That does not matter," said the first. "What matters is that he will be accused."
"He will be accused," said I, "but he may not be guilty." Emily's long eyes shifted along the company and apparently decided those within hearing were safe for this line of conversation. "There are easier ways of making away with one's wife," she said, "than having it done in front of half a dozen witnesses." "And a better way of arranging it," said I, "than to leave behind a dagger that will point straight to you." The others had not heard of this development. While I was explaining about the carved jasper pommel, the sounds of the chase came from the front of the building, yips and shouts, as a pack of gentlemen raced off in pursuit of the assassin. They had come for the chase, had been confined indoors to their frustration, and now launched themselves on this new hunt with all the joy and vigour they would have applied to the pursuit of a stag. While those around the fireplace discussed Broughton's future, I considered my own. I was not involved in this assassination, save as a witness. Therefore, I decided, I was free to act on my own. An equerry arrived from the Queen, asking members of the Great Council to attend Her Majesty, and many of the company left, while the party around the fireplace dispersed. I found myself with Emily, the two of us disposed around a chess table. I reached down and picked a carved walnut knight from the table. "I think I may ride out," I said. She looked up at me.
"Are you going to pursue the assassin after all? Can you catch him after all this time?"
"I think I may be able to identify him if I ride to Selford." She looked off through the diamond pane windows at the yeoman archers on the lawn, preparing to depart. She frowned.
"I wonder if that knowledge would be to anyone's benefit," she wondered. I was surprised.
"If your ladyship thinks I should not go," I said, "I will remain here. I cannot say whether your errand is for good or ill," she said, "and I hardly think the Queen's party will remain at the lodge in any case. I'm sure the council will recommend a return to Selford, but it will take the rest of the day to organize it, and Her Majesty will not leave till tomorrow."
"Then if I may have your leave?"
She looked at me with some slight surprise, as if she were surprised I asked her permission.
"Of course. Try not to be captured by brigands or assassins on the way."
I smiled. "I will happily comply.
And should you find the villain, think carefully what you do."
This seemed curious advice, so I merely said that I would, bowed, and went to my room. I changed into boots, leather riding jerkin, and trousers, and stuffed everything else in my saddlebags. I donned my overcoat and also brought a hooded cloak against rain. I stopped by the kitchens and begged a pair of venison pies, which I put in my coat pockets. I filled my leather bottle with small beer, then I made my way to the stables, where the captain of the yeoman archers was just departing with his party of pursuers, all armed with swords and pistols. Though I had no hopes of riding down the assassin, I intended to set a brisk pace, for I had 12 leagues to cover before nightfall, when the city gates would be closed against me. I knew not whether I could bribe my way past the guards, and I preferred not to have to test their honesty one way or another. The yeoman archers spurred away. Perhaps I should remark that I never saw a man of the yeoman archers carrying a bow, as the corps was armed entirely with pikes, swords, and firelocks. Modern warfare may have made the bow obsolete, but so devoted to tradition was the palace that its guards remained archers in name, and probably would remain archers so long as the palace continued to stand. As I was saddling my mount, Emily appeared, with her maids, coachman, footman, and baggage. I looked at her in surprise. "I've decided to follow your example, Goodman Quillifer," said she, "and abandon this sad cockpit of ruined ambition." "I am, and that is a quote from Bellow, is it not?" "I know not, and I care not," said she. "You may join me in the carriage, if you like." I debated with myself whether or not to accept her offer. I truly wanted to get to the city as soon as I could, and though a ride with Emily would be diverting, there would almost certainly be delays. Yet, I thought, if the assassin was in Selford tonight, he would probably still be there tomorrow. I joined Emily in her carriage. She ordered the carriage's top lowered, so we might enjoy the air, but we and her servants had to wrap warmly in furs against the cold day. Her 4 horses were matched, and of the breed called Cremello, white, with rose-pink noses and brilliant blue eyes. Not only were they a striking and beautiful quartet, they set a rattling pace, and my fears of being delayed soon faded. Indeed, my borrowed beast, following on a lead, was hard put to keep up. We wound our way through the Queen's Forest, splashed through puddles and detoured around fallen limbs. It was not long before we encountered the first of the pursuers returning. They had galloped after their quarry as though he were a stag, and soon enough their horses were blown, and they were forced to return. You would think that this possibility might have occurred, even to the nobility, well before they spurred off. Those who actually cared about their animals led them home on foot, and the rest rode lathered, staggering, pitiful beasts. Once we were on the main road, Emily had a bottle of wine opened, and I shared my meat pies. Our conversation was lively, for the maids remained excited by the morning's developments, and during their tenure in the servants' quarters had managed to absorb quite a number of rumours. For instance, was the would-be assassin hired by Balodda's scheming half-brother, Claiborne, by the ambassador from Loretto, by Broughton, or by the Queen herself? Why would Claiborne want to kill the Viscountess? Emily scorned, though she did put some effort into an examination of the theory that one or another ambassador was behind it, in order to secure the Queen for his prince. While this speculation was taking place, I was able to take Emily's hand beneath the fur that we shared, and now and again stroke her thigh, causing her to take a little intake of breath. But I dared not risk that intake of breath too often, not under the sharp eyes of the 2 maidservants, nor take any other liberties. Howsoever, judging by the gleam in her eye, I believe that at least one of the maids was very taken with me during that ride, though I did not put this surmise to the test. As we rode, we encountered more and more of the pursuers, all returning to the lodge. Though none of these had blown their horses in an over-hasty pursuit, they had all concluded they stood no chance of catching the assassin, and turned around in time to enjoy supper at the lodge. Last of all was the dispirited troop of yeoman archers, who had pursued longer than the others. The lieutenant had been sent on to warn the capital's gate guards, just in case the fugitive had spent part of the day hiding and rode in after nightfall, but the rest were riding their weary way back to the lodge to report their failure to Queen Balodda. Even though the carriage maintained a good pace when the road was clear, still we followed the storm, and the road was full of mud and muck and fallen limbs, some of which were so heavy that the footman and I could barely shift them. This meant delays, and shadows were growing long by the time we passed Shaunside's royal castle. "We will probably not make Selford before nightfall," I said. "Your ladyship might want to look for an inn."
"Oh, that will not be necessary."
She gave me a look from out of those long eyes. "We have a country house not far from here, and I've sent word ahead, and will sleep and sup there. The steward will find a bed for you somewhere, if you are not bent on galloping for the capital tonight." And as her hand grazed along my thigh as she spoke her invitation, I overcame feigned reluctance and accepted. "The fugitive will still be there tomorrow," I decided, assuming he is there at all. The promised bed was on the same floor as Emily's chambers and was very comfortable. Not that I spent a lot of time in it. For as soon as the house grew quiet, I stole down the hall to quietly knock on Emily's door, and the two of us spent a delightful night beneath the grand canopy of her bed, thoughts of murder and conspiracy forgotten beneath pleasure and laughter. When I finally fell asleep, I slept so well that in the morning I was hard put to scramble back to my room before the servant came up to bring me my shaving water. After breakfast, I put on my grateful, suppliant face, kissed Emily's hand, and rode off to the capital, where I arrived before mid-morn. Low clouds hung over the day, and the wind was brisk. I returned my horse to the livery stable in Mossthorpe, and walked across the bridge to Selford, with my saddlebags on my shoulder, then to my lodgings on Chancellery Street. I emptied my saddlebags, then, without changing out of my riding leathers, walked to Clattering Lane, where all the knife and sword makers clustered and viewed the signs overhanging the street. With the ringing sound of hammers on anvils echoing on either hand, I found the sign shaped like a shield with a crown in its centre, and entered the shop of Rosen Crowninshield, whose surname, as I discovered when I asked for the master, was pronounced something like Grunsel. I asked Master Crowninshield about the sword-hilted dagger with the Broughton badge, and he remembered it quite well. He had made the dagger himself, and it had been on display in his shop. A customer had walked in from the street and bought it, on condition that the plain steel pommel be replaced by one with the Broughton blazon. Crowninshield customarily worked with a cameo carver on such commissions, and both were paid extra for carving and mounting the jasper carving swiftly. Crowninshield was told that the dagger was a gift for Broughton's son. He was hardly to be blamed for not knowing that no such son existed. "Who commissioned the dagger?" I asked, and was surprised to hear that it was a lady. I asked for a description. Crowninshield's lengthy description, given with many digressions over 4 or 5 minutes, amounted to the lady being generally lady-shaped and having a face similar in large degree to that of a lady. Her accent was either that of Bonnell or of South Fornland, neither of which resembled one another. I made a note to myself that, should I ever be qualified as a lawyer, never to call Crowninshield as a witness. "Not a grand lady, mind," he added, "but respectable. Maybe a servant, but a superior sort of servant, a housekeeper or a governess." In order to protect myself from any housekeepers and governesses and their murder plots, I bought a sword-hilted dagger of my very own and thrust it into my belt, behind, under my cloak, where I could draw it easily with the right hand. I then thanked Master Grunsel and made my way to Saddler's Row, where I failed to find any shop signs displaying a sparrow, warbler, or any small bird. This sent me farther up the road to the Honourable Company of Loriners and Saddlers, where a helpful apprentice showed me the book of marks used by members of the guild, and found the bird mark straight away.
"That would be the shop of Dagobert Finch, sir," he said.
"Where would I find it?"
"Across the river, in Mossthorpe."
So I retraced my steps across the great bridge to the house of Finch in Mossthorpe. The shop was rich with the scent of leather and prime neat's foot oil, and saddles hung beneath the roof beams like carcasses at my father's butchery. Master Saddler Finch was a short, peppery man with a bristly moustache.
"I sell a great many saddles, Yonker," said he.
"This would have been sold to a gentleman about my height," I said. "Wore a beard when I met him yesterday. He rides a liver chestnut." I saw from a sudden gleam in Finch's eye that he recognized my description, but then his look grew cautious.
"Why do you want to know?"
"I owe him money," said I. "We were both at the hunt at Kingsmere 2 days ago, and we wagered on one of the gentlemen fighting a stag with a sword, and I lost. Yet in the excitement of the betting, I failed to note the gentleman's name."
"Yet it is unusual for a man to pursue another and all to willingly give money away."
"I can afford it," I said. "I won my other bets." And to demonstrate my prosperity, I passed a couple of crowns across the table.
"Sir Hector Burgoyne," said Finch, "a military gentleman, yes? He will be glad of your money. He commissioned the saddle over a year ago, but I only gave it to him last month when he finally paid the balance on his account."
"Know you where he lives?"
"Nay, Junker, but he keeps his courser at Mundy's on the main road, and they will probably know."
So off I went to Mundy's livery stable, and one of the grooms, once I had given him his veil, was able to direct me to Burgoyne's garret in Selford, in the stew called Ramscallion Lane. Wearing my hood over my head, I found the building without trouble, a half-timbered structure sagging over the street, with ancient thatch hanging over the eaves, like untidy bangs over a scarred forehead. It hardly seemed the sort of place for a knight to lodge unless he was desperate for money, desperate enough to commit murder, I supposed. A fetid, rank odour hung about the lane, both from the rubbish thrown in the streets and the ditch that ran behind the neighbourhood, a ditch full of the sewage of the district, as well as that which had run down the hill. I kept my hand on my purse the entire visit to avoid being robbed by the thieves, custrels, apple squires, and trulls that infested the district. I could see my silver reflected in their pouched, greedy eyes. I now had a number of choices. I could apprehend Burgoyne myself, but cared little for the idea of nabbing a desperate villain in a rat hole like Ramscallion Lane. I could hire some professional thief-takers, but that would cost money. I could disdain the thief-takers and go to a magistrate who would give me a warrant, but then I would still have to find someone to serve the warrant and be scarcely any better than I had before. I might go to the sheriff if he was in the city and not elsewhere in the county, but then he would bring his own thief-takers and probably claim credit for the arrest. I could not go to the Attorney General for the simple reason that Queen Bolodda had not yet appointed one. The one place I absolutely could not go was the barracks of the Yeoman Archers. The city of Selford rejoiced in its traditional liberties, which included freedom from interference by the Queen's army. The army was forbidden to apprehend lawbreakers or otherwise disturb the orderly business of criminality, unless there was hue and cry, in which case soldiers could apprehend a felon while acting in the character of private individuals rather than members of a military company, or if there was a riot or insurrection and a magistrate certified that the Act to Prevent Tumult applied, in which case the army was allowed to massacre at will. Should the pursuing archers have caught the assassin, I thought, it would have raised an interesting point. Could Sir Hector Burgoyne claim at his trial that his arrest was illegal, as the army had no right to apprehend him? Of course, the prosecution could claim that a hue and cry had been raised, but the defence could counter that a hue and cry only applied when the quarry was actually in sight. I would have enjoyed arguing it either way. To apprehend Burgoyne, I might go to a member of the Watch, but the Watch were mostly elderly pensioners who wandered the city at night, calling that all was well while ringing a bell. The point of the bell was to let everyone know they weren't sleeping on duty. If a watchman discovered a fire or a crime in progress, he did not intervene, but rang the bell continuously and called for help.
The decrepit, underpaid members of the Watch were unlikely to provide enough brawn to apprehend a vigorous, unscrupulous man in Ramscallion. Selford and the law provided any number of ways to take up a criminal, and none of them were of any use to me. So it must be the thief-takers after all. I went up Chancellery Road to the courts where such people made themselves available for hire, and acquired for 3 crowns each, and a share in any reward, the services of 2 very large men named Merton and Toland. From their broken noses, missing teeth, and the scars on their pates, I marked them as former prize fighters, which meant they had practical experience in the ring against opponents carrying broadswords, halberds, and flails. Toland, indeed, looked as if his entire face had been flattened in a collision with a buckler. I explained that Burgoyne was wanted for attempted murder and warned that he was a former military man and probably dangerous. "Should I not hire some more men?" asked I.
"Nay, sir,"
Merton spoke in a plausible, peaceful voice that belied his formidable appearance.
"We too are used to taking felons quietly, and if we bring a large group into the Ramscallion, we're asking for trouble. Let's keep the reward between the 3 of us.
Merton nodded sagely.
"And I will need another couple of crowns."
"For what purpose?"
"For the landlady, so she won't make a fuss."
This was sensible, and I passed over the silver. I was a little surprised when, even after my warnings, the thief-takers armed themselves only with wooden cudgels, which they hid beneath their cloaks. "Are you sure those clubs will do the job?" I asked. Merton seemed offended.
"Sir, they haven't failed yet. Our veteran crown knockers must have tamed 100 villains and turned them docile as little fuff cats."
We made our way down the hill to Ramscallion Lane, and while the stench of the ditch clawed at the back of my throat, I pointed out Burgoyne's building. Merton and Toland gave it a professional survey, then Merton disappeared inside. I followed, and in the deep interior darkness of the hall, saw one of my crowns make an appearance and vanish into the grimy hands of a beak-nosed slattern on the ground floor.
"Sir Hector?" Merton inquired.
"Top of the stair, uphill side."
Merton wasted no time with thanks, but stuck his head out the door and gestured to his partner.
"Master Toland will stay outside the house," he explained, "to make certain that Sir Hector does not escape by his window. You should stand with him, if you please, and I'll houster out this villain."
"I'll go with you," said I. Merton made no reply and went to the stair. I doubt he cared whether I lived or died, but he had done his duty in trying to keep me away from any violence. There was no light on the stair, and its upper reaches were black as midnight. The steps creaked and shuddered under Merton's weight. My hand reached for the hilt of my new dagger. Then there was a flash and a shot louder than thunder, and Merton pitched backward, dead, into my arms. I struggled with the weight of the body as I gaped in astonishment up the stair, and there in the gloom I saw Burgoyne looking, more or less as I'd last seen him, in a hat and a long coat, but this time with a big horse pistol in his fist. He looked down at me in a searching, contemplative way, as if he were trying to work out where he'd seen me before. Then he turned and vanished into the murk. My ears, still ringing from the shot, could still mark the clank of his roweled spurs as he retreated. I laid Merton down on the steep stair, and one look told me that he was dead, having been shot with a heavy pistol ball right in the middle of his forehead. I was staring down at the man's face, my heart beating high in my throat, when Toland came running in and staggered to a halt at the sight of his partner. Anger and excitement blazed up in me like sparks in a forge.
"Burgoyne shot him," I said. "Let's take him."
I drew my dagger and hurled myself up the stair, stumbling over the body as I went. The top of the stair reeked of powder, but that scent was fresh and wholesome compared to the other smells of the place. I got to the top and saw grey light at the end of the passage, and I lurched toward it, stumbling over rubbish that people had left in the corridor. I burst through the low doorway at the end of the hall and found myself outside, at the top of another steep stair made of weathered planks that dropped onto the narrow path that ran alongside the sewer ditch behind the ramscallion. A dark, sinister muck, thicker than treacle, oozed down the ditch. Dead dogs floated belly up in the mire, and the place stank worse than a charnel house. Burgoyne was 50 feet down the path, loping comfortably along as he looked over his shoulder at me. Even at this distance, I could see that he retained that thoughtful expression with which he had viewed me from the top of the stair. If my blood hadn't been burning hot in my veins, if I hadn't been half mad with the frenzy of pursuit, I would have understood that look for what it was, the calculating glance of a professional as he evaluated his foe. Burgoyne had taken out the lever used to rewind his pistol, and he was cranking the wheel lock as he hastened down the path. Even in my state of excitement, I calculated that he couldn't possibly have had time to pour powder and ball down the barrel or prime the pistol to fire, and I knew that I had to catch him before he could reload. I dived down the steep, rickety stair, 3 steps at a time, and charged after him. Apparently, he realized the futility of reloading, and he turned away and began to run faster. "Stop!" I shouted. "Stop!" The words "hue and cry" flashed through my mind, and I realized that "stop" and "stop, thief" were probably heard 20 times a day in the Ranscallion, only to raise laughter and derision on the part of the inhabitants. "Stop, murderer!" I shouted. "Reward for the murderer!" I guessed that the promise of reward might well bring more aid than a plea for help, and indeed, as we ran along, I saw windows opening and faces peering past shutters.
"Reward!" I cried. "Reward for the murderer!"
At the words, Burgoyne cast a choleric look over his shoulder, but kept running. The path was slippery and choked with rubbish and a truly astounding array of dead animals, and we both had trouble keeping our feet under us. Still, I closed the distance. Looking ahead, I could see a broad grey expanse of water, the sail swollen at high tide and backing the water up into the ditch. And I realized that Burgoyne was going to have to turn left to run along the river's bank, or else wade across the horrid ditch, which I could not imagine him doing if he had a choice. And indeed, he went neither left nor right. At the end of the path, he turned, drew his rapier, and directed its point at my breast. My blood went from scalding hot to frigid cold in an instant. I stopped in mid-career, my feet sliding in the mud 5 yards away from the point of the sword. I stared at the weapon, which seemed long as a lance. My dagger now seemed preposterously inadequate as a weapon.
"Thus, boy," said Burgoyne, "your chase is brought to an end."
His accent was that of Northern Bonnell. I gasped, my heart thrashing in its cage, then drew in a breath and called out,
"Reward for the murderer!"
He snarled at me, his teeth flashing white in his beard.
"Pursue me further, and I'll murder you in truth."
I saw an old bottle lying by the path, and I bent and flung it at him. He dodged it with an easy, contemptuous shift of his hips. Next to me was a tumbled-down stone wall, once a part of a shed, and I bent to pick up a stone. Burgoyne turned and vanished down the sail embankment. For an instant, I readied myself to chase again. Then I thought that he might lurk just around the corner of the last building, before the embankment, waiting for me to run into range of his rapier. I looked at the old shed on my left, with its broken wall and half-fallen roof beams. I put my dagger in my teeth, an expedient I would have found ridiculous had I seen it in a play, and I jumped atop the half-fallen wall and hoisted myself from thence to the roof beams. I jumped along the beams, the shed shaking under my weight, then leaped from there to the mouldy old thatch of an ancient, decrepit house. My footfalls nearly silent on the straw, I rustled across the roof's ridge, then down the other side. I saw that my shouts and the promise of reward had brought out some of the more enterprising inhabitants of the district, men rough and dubious, and some of these stood at the end of Ramscallion Lane, looking along the side of the building on which I stood. It was no great deduction on my part to conclude that their neighbour,
Burgoyne stood there. I ventured to peer over the edge of the roof, and I saw from above Burgoyne's broad hat at the corner of the building. He was, as I suspected, waiting for me to come dashing around to be skewered like a capon. I disappointed him, apparently, because the hat tilted as he peered around the corner and failed to see me. Then he turned and appeared in plain sight, walking toward Ramscallion Lane with his rapier still in his hand. He called to his neighbours, "D'ye see that troublesome urchin anywhere?" Some of them looked up at me on the thatch, and I knew he'd follow their glance and realize I was above him, and so I snatched the dagger out of my teeth and leaped. I landed behind and to his left side, near enough that I fell into him and knocked him toward the sail, but more importantly, I'd brought the pommel of the dagger down on top of his head as I came down. His hat protected his crown somewhat, but he was dazed, and when I rose from the crouch into which the fall had sent me, I was on him, my left hand clutched around his coat collar, while my right struck again with the hilt of the dagger. As long as I stayed close, he couldn't use the rapier. I did not want to stab him. It was clear Burgoyne was a hireling merely, and I wanted to haul him before a magistrate for interrogation and have him reveal the source of the conspiracy. As I pummeled my quarry, I could hear shouts of joy from the Ramscallions in the lane. I'm sure they love nothing so much as a fight. Burgoyne managed to fend off most of my blows as I wrenched him around by his collar, shaking him as a terrier shakes a rat. He tried to strike with the hilt of the rapier, but I parried with my own weapon and cut a gash in his overcoat sleeve. I smashed at his head again and was warded off. I know not what happened next, but somehow he twisted under me. I felt a hand grasp my left wrist, and suddenly I was tumbling through the air. I landed on my back with some force, but panic picked me from the ground and rolled me forward to my feet. Plain murder gleamed pale in his eyes. My heart sank as I realized that he could now use his rapier, and I leaped back and parried with the knife as the narrow blade sprang for my vitals. He charged on and I skipped away, out into Ramscallion Lane, with our audience scattering as the blades gleamed in the day's dull light. Burgoyne paused in his pursuit as he gasped for breath. I pointed at him. "Reward!" I cried. "Reward for the murderer!" Burgoyne snarled and lunged at me again, and I danced away. We were in a growing half-circle of observers, men and women, and laughing children. Anticipation, cruelty, and greed shone in their eyes, as if we were dogs fighting in a pit for their entertainment. I pointed again. "Knock him down," said I. "Throw rocks, throw bottles, trip him up, there's a reward."
"How much?"
asked some pragmatist. But a young man hurled a bottle, and it whistled past Burgoyne's head. He glared at his neighbour and mouthed a curse. More bottles followed, and pans and stones. A slop pot, hurled from an upper story, landed at his feet and spat at him with its contents. I had turned the neighbourhood into my accomplices. Burgoyne fended off most of the missiles, but they slowed him down, and then one caught him on the forehead, and after that, blood poured into his eyes, and he had to keep wiping them. I could see the resolve building in him, and so I was ready when he made another attempt to kill me, running at me with the sword thrusting for my heart, and I would have got away if the growing crowd hadn't hampered me. Suddenly I was within range of the blade, and I frantically twisted away from it as it plucked at the buttons of my leather riding jerkin. I stabbed at him with my knife and felt the blade enter the right shoulder. And then one of the crowd failed to get out of the way in time, and I tripped over him and fell. And there I was, helpless, as the killer stood over me with growing triumph in his eyes. His arm came back for the final thrust. At which point, the thief-taker, Toland, who had come up through the crowd, swung his cudgel and caught Burgoyne behind the ear, and so laid the murderer out atop me. Emily and I lay like spoons in my lodgings off Chancellery Road, my hand warm on her pregnant belly. She wore only her jewellery, gems on her fingers, and a carcanet of gold and rubies about her throat. The strands of pearls she'd woven into her hair had come loose and lay on the pillow.
Her languorous tones were regretful, and I vibrated with resentment. Nothing had ended as I planned. "I regret extremely to give you this advice," she said, "but I think it best if you stayed away from court for the present." I felt defiance straighten my spine. "I have done nothing wrong," said I. "I have, in fact, done the Queen a service. Why should I hide?" "The whole world knows of the Queen's distaste for your presence," said she. "Should you appear at court, any who hope for royal favour will be obliged to shun you. It will be humiliating and will do your cause no good." I thought for a long moment. Anger boomed dully in my veins. "I understand," said I. "Other matters will soon occupy the court's attention. After that, you may return." She turned and looked at me, compassion showing in her long eyes. "I warned you, did I not, that you should think before you acted?" "You did," said I. "A court conspiracy," said she, "is sometimes better left unmasked. If you meant to help Broughton, you failed. If you meant to uncover the guilty, you succeeded all too well. The Queen was forced to take action, and well does she resent you for making her take notice of the intrigue at her court." After the capture of Burgoyne, Toland and I had taken the renegade knight to a magistrate, accompanied by a pack of the inhabitants of Ramscallion Lane. The sheriff's men turned out not because of the prisoner, but because they thought a riot was about to begin. While Burgoyne was marched to jail, I led the mob to one of the counting houses where I kept my funds. At the sight of this pack of unruly stew dwellers, the good bankers began locking doors and slamming shutters, certain they were about to be stormed by an angry rabble. It took a bit of negotiation, but eventually I was allowed inside to collect some of my silver, after which I paid the mob to go away. That same morning, before leaving Kingsmere for the capital, the Queen announced a reward of 300 royal for the assassin, then appointed Lord Slaithstow to be the new Attorney General and put the investigation into his hands. Slaithstow rode ahead of the Queen's party and arrived late in the afternoon to find Burgoyne already in custody. The next day, Slaithstow spent in putting the assassin to the question before the court of the Siege Royal and coercing him to name his accomplices. What Slaithstow heard probably had him tearing his beard out by the roots, but he did his duty, copied the transcript of the interrogation in his own hand, not trusting anyone else, and reported to the Queen first thing the next morning. For Burgoyne admitted that he was in the pay of the Queen's own mother, the divorced Queen Leonora. Leonora rejoiced in her place near the Queen and feared losing the Queen's love to the interloper, Broughton. And in addition, Leonora, for reasons of policy, favoured Balodda's marriage to Loretto's prince and heir, not to a minor viscount with a pretty face. Leonora's father had been Burgoyne's liege lord before Burgoyne had gone abroad to serve in foreign wars. He had come home to Bonnell with a competence, but being a rake and gambler, had lost it all. Leonora gave him a few crowns now and again and kept him in reserve in case she needed someone to intercept a messenger or cut a throat. And then came the inspiration to kill Broughton's wife and blame the husband for the deed. It was one of the Dowager Queen's ladies who commissioned the dagger with the Broughton badge. Queen Balodda must have been appalled and devastated by the news, but she lacked neither courage nor resolution. Burgoyne was sent to the gallows that very day. Queen Leonora was ordered to the royal residence and fort at West Moss, beyond the Munith Peaks, as far from the capital as it is possible to travel without actually wading out into the ocean. She would remain there indefinitely, at the Queen's pleasure. As for Broughton, the scandal was too great for a man without powerful friends to survive. Though he was innocent of anything but ambition, he was obliged to resign his post as Master of the Hunt, given the new office of Inspector General of Fortifications, and sent off to view and report on the state of every fort, castle, and city wall in the kingdom. And, as he had borrowed heavily to outfit himself as a great man at court and to provide the entertainments at Kingsmere, he would be pursued on this pilgrimage by his creditors or their representatives. Whether Lady Broughton rejoiced in the return of her husband, I do not know. An official announcement was made that Burgoyne had been hanged after an attempt to assassinate the Queen. No mention was made of Dowager Queen Leonora, though everyone at court knew the story within hours. Those responsible for the violence were punished, but the punishment did not stop there. For Balodda deeply resented losing everyone she loved and trusted, and viewed without charity those who had brought her to this pass. She could not abide the sight of Lord Slaithstow, and found the pain of his presence too much to bear. He kept his office less than a week, which must have been a great blow, as he had performed his duty as well as it could be done, and he lost also the sweetness he would have been paid by anyone whose business brought them before the Attorney General, a sum that over time would have been a great fortune. Instead, he was appointed Commissioner of the Royal Dockyard in Amberstone, where the opportunities for enrichment were small by comparison. And as for me, I, who had been the subject of praise and the object of envy on my return to court the day after my capture of Burgoyne, I was told merely that the sight of me was disagreeable to Her Majesty and that I should keep clear of the royal presence. Unlike Slaithstow, I was not offered a job, lest the offer be construed as a reward rather than a punishment. I still waited for the 300 royals promised for Burgoyne. If I ever received it, I would divide it evenly between Toland, Merton's family, and my own declining fortune. Amelie was still willing to see me, but then a Marchioness of Steyne was almost as grand as the Queen, and she could set her own fashions. Still, she could not be seen with me in public, and only visited my lodgings for a few hours now and again. Our dalliance, like the season, would soon enough reach its wintertide, for in a few months she would give birth to Steyne's heir, and Steyne himself would return from captivity. Sometimes I missed her even when she was in my arms. I wondered if virtue had triumphed over iniquity, as in Blackwell's Mask. Balodda's court had been cleansed of one conspirator and one adulterous nobleman, but no doubt there were many of that sort who remained. The court was also rid of one half-lawyer who trusted too much to his own luck and had suffered the consequence of that trust. I could almost hear the laughter ringing down from the roof beams. Was it virtue who laughed in her chaste home, or was the laughter that of her demi-colleague, iniquity? Whoever it was who laughed, it was clear that I was not in virtue's camp as long as Amelie visited my bed. And so I kissed the fine tawny hair that grew at the base of her neck, thanked her for her advice, and set myself to amuse her, that she might soon choose again to visit me in my exile.
Daniel Abraham. Daniel Abraham lives with his family in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he is director of technical support at a local internet service provider. Starting off his career in short fiction, he made sales to Asimov's Science Fiction, Sci Fiction, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Realms of Fantasy, The Infinite Matrix, Vanishing Acts, The Silver Web, Bones of the World, The Dark, Wild Cards, and elsewhere, some of which appeared in his first collection, Leviathan Wept, and other stories. Turning to novels, he made several sales in rapid succession, including the books of The Long Price Quartet, which consist of A Shadow in Summer, A Betrayal in Winter, An Autumn War, and The Price of Spring. He's also written The Dagger and the Coin series, which consists of The Dragon's Path, The King's Blood, The Tyrant's Law, The Widow's House, and most recently, The Spider's War. He also wrote Hunter's Run, a collaborative novel with George R.R. Martin and Gardner Dozois, as M.L.N. Hanover wrote the four-volume paranormal romance series Black Sun's Daughter, and with Ty Frank, writing as James S.A. Corey, the space opera Expanse novels, which have been made into a popular TV series, consisting of Leviathan Wakes, Caliban's War, Abaddon's Gate, Gods of Risk, Cibula Burn, Nemesis Games, and Babylon's Ashes. Here he takes us along with companions trying to penetrate to the heart of a daunting and deadly mystery, and discovering that what they find is not at all what they expected to find.
The Mocking Tower by Daniel Abraham. Old Owl saw the thief first. Squatting in the garden, she commanded a long view of the East Road. Gray flagstone, straighter than nature, amid the green scrub and bramble. Rich soil breathed its scent around her as she took an offending root in one hand and her garden knife in the other. Between the moment she began sawing and when she pulled the first tangle of dirt and pale vegetable flesh out of the ground, the thief appeared, a dot on the horizon. She worked as he approached. His cloak hung limp in the humid summer air. His hat, wide as his shoulders, shadowed his eyes. He wore an empty scabbard across his back. Old Owl paused when he grew close. When he reached the wall of ancient stone that marked the border between the greater world and the protected lands within, he paused and looked toward the mocking tower. The tower shimmered, as the tales all said it would, appearing to change shape between one breath and the next. A great thrusting pillar of alabaster studded with living torches became an ancient palace of gray stone and moss, became a rose-colored complication of terraces stacked one atop another toward the sky. The thief took in the illusionist's art with an air of haughtiness and satisfaction. Old Owl watched the man watch the tower, cleared her throat, and nodded to the stranger. "What news?" she asked. His gaze shifted to the old woman. His eyes looked as if they'd been dyed the same blue as a storm cloud. The lines around his mouth and eyes spoke of age and weather, but Old Owl thought she saw a boyishness in them as well, like the image of an acorn worked in oak. Something in him reminded Old Owl of a lover she'd taken years before, a man of high station who dreamed of living as a gardener. Dead now, and his dreams with him, except for what she carried with her. When the thief spoke, his voice carried the richness and depth of a reed instrument softly played. "The throne stands empty," the thief said. "King Ron rots in his grave, and the princes vie to claim his place."
"All seven of them?" "Tauin, Mausch, and Kinnan all fell to their brother's blades. Another, Aus by name, rose from the south with a foreign army at his back to lay a new claim. Five armies still cross the land, and blight wherever they pass." "Shame that," Old Owl said. "Wars end, even wars of succession. They also create certain unexpected opportunities for the bold," he said, then shifted, as by moving his shoulders he moved the conversation. "These lands belong to the Yamagi Vert." Old Owl shrugged, pointing to the stone wall with her chin. "Everything within the border and all the way round. Not subject to the throne, nor the one before it, nor to whatever comes next, either. The Mocking Tower stands apart from the world, and the Yamagi Vert sees to that, once and eternal. You've come on behalf of one of the princes? Plead the Yamagi to take a side, maybe?"
"The tale I hear told says the Yamagi Vert took King Ron's soul when he died and fashioned it into a blade. And the blade lies somewhere in that tower. I have come to steal it."
Old Owl wiped a soil-darkened hand across her cheek, squinting first at the thief, then at the mocking tower, and back to the thief. His chin lifted as if in challenge. The empty scabbard tapped against his back as if asking for attention. Green lacquer and brass fittings, and long enough to hold even a fairly large sword. as though a king's soul surely required a palatial blade to hold it.
You make it a habit to announce that sort of thing, do you?
Old Owl said as she brushed the soil off the length of pale, stubborn roots still in the earth.
Seems an odd way to get what you want.
The thief's attention returned to her. A smile both bright and brief flickered on his lips.
I'm sure you know a great deal about gardening. I know a great deal about theft. This road leads to the township at the tower's base.
Old Owl nodded.
Another hour down the road. Keep left at the crossing or you'll find yourself heading south without much besides grain silos and the mill for company. But take the warning. Everyone you find there is loyal to the Imagi Vert. Anyone not tends to leave fair quick.
I don't plan to stay.
You have a name, friend?
Old Owl asked.
Many of them.
The thief slid a hand into his sleeve and drew it back out. Something small and bright between his fingers caught the sunlight. He tossed the coin to Old Owl, and she caught it without thinking. A square of silver with a young man's likeness pressed into the metal. Some prince or another. One of the king's warring brood.
This for my silence?
Old Owl asked.
For your help in directing me, the thief said. Anything more lies between you and your conscience.
Old Owl chuckled, nodded, and tucked the coin in her belt. The thief in his empty scabbard stepped off down the road. His stride shifted his cloak from side to side, like the flourish of a street magician's right hand, distracting from the actions of the left. His hat carried shadow under its brim like a veil. The mocking tower changed to a soaring complex of chains hanging from a stonework tree taller than clouds, to a spiral of basalt with stairways cut into the sides. Old Owl shook her head and bent back down to her work. The stubborn root defied her, but she was stern and hard and well practiced with a garden knife. When it came out, long as her arm and pale as bone, she squatted in the churned black soil, wiped the sweat from her face, and looked west after the thief. The curve of the road and the trees hit him already. The township that served the Imagi Vert pretended normalcy, even in the shadow of magic. Only the central square boasted flagstone. Dust, dirt, and weeds made up all the streets. The small stables reeked like stables anywhere, and pisspots stood in the alleys, waiting to be taken and their contents sold to the launderer to whiten cloth, or the tanner to soften hide. The flowers of early summer drew bees and flies. The sun warmed thatched roofs until they stank a little. Birds chattered and warned each other from their nests. Dogs ran here as they did anywhere, chasing squirrels and each other. A few hundred feet to the north, the mocking tower loomed, a spire of bone and glass. Then a pillar of plate-thin stones stacked one atop the other toward the sky. Then a spiral of what looked like skinned flesh. Then an ivy-clad maiden of granite with a crown of living flame. The people of the township viewed the thief as the greater curiosity. He walked through the streets, eyes hidden, but with a cheerful smile. The empty scabbard bumped against his back with every step. The traveler's hearth stood just down from the square, and at an angle, like a servant with eyes politely averted. The thief went to it, as if he stayed there often. The keeper, a fat man, wearing the traditional iron chain of hospitality wrapping his left arm, greeted him in the courtyard.
I need only a small room, the thief said.
No small rooms, nor any big ones either, the fat man said. Just rooms is all.
All people claim the same dignity before the Imagi, the thief said, as if joking.
Just so, just so. Seaman can take your horse if you have one.
Seaman, a lanky, dark-haired boy with a simple, open face, nodded hopefully. The thief shook his head and handed 3 of the square silver coins to the fat man.
I only take what I can carry.
The keeper considered the coins as if they spelled out the future, then pressed his lips tight and shrugged. The iron chain clinked as if offering its own metallic thoughts. Seaman broke the silence.
I can show you the way anyhow.
Very kind of you, the thief said.
Seaman trotted ahead, leading the thief down short halls and into a hidden courtyard of cherry trees. A stone cistern loomed in a corner, where a thin-limbed girl scrubbed away moss with a black-bristled brush and tried not to stare. The thief nodded to her. She blushed and nodded back. Seaman stopped at a high door, the color of fresh cream, opening the brass latch with a click. The thief stepped into his private room, and the boy trotted along behind him. The air smelled of soap and lilac. Shadows clung to the pale walls like stepping into a sudden twilight. A modest bed, with a dark brown, rough-woven blanket of the sort common to the southern tribes 100 years before. An ironwork sculpture of an iris in a frame hung on the wall opposite the only window. An earthenware jug and cup sat on a low table beside 3 unlit candles. Seaman, smiling, closed the shutters, as if the thief had asked him to. The shadows grew deeper. The thief sank slowly to the bed. The empty scabbard clattered on the floor where he dropped it. He swept off his hat and let it sit beside him, covered in pollen and dust. Sweat-dark locks of hair stuck to his balding scalp. His cheerful smile vanished, and fear took its place. He shook his head, pressed a palm to his brow, and shook his head again.
I can't do this.
You can. Seaman, whose name was not Seaman, snapped, his own affectation of boyish goodwill falling away. And you will.
Did you see that tower? I've heard tales of the Mocking Tower. Everyone has. I thought it would, I don't know, catch the sunlight oddly, cast weird shadows. Seems to shift moment by moment, they say, huh? Too damned true. How do I put myself against a wizard who can do that?
Seaman leaned against the wall, arms folded across his chest. You don't. I do.
We're making a mistake. We should go back.
Back to what? Fire and death? We keep to the plan, the boy said. Get the sword, end the war. The thief sagged forward, elbows against his knees, head in his hands.
If you say.
Then, gathering himself, did you find it? Seaman poured water from the jug into the cup and handed it to the thief as he spoke.
No, but with you here, they'll show me. Whatever changes, wherever the guard increases, whatever they keep you from, that's how I'll know. You strike the drum, and I listen to the echoes for answers. It works that way. And the more they watch you, the less they watch me.
I know, the thief said, then paused to drink the cup dry. He handed it back, wiping his lips with a sleeve.
I liked this plan better before I came here. Successions and thrones and blood and armies in the field. Now magic swords and wizards, and a tower like something that's crawled out of a bad dream. I don't belong in something like this.
Go in the morning. Talk to everyone you can find. Ask about green glass.
Green glass? Why?
I found a private temple not far from the tower fashioned from it. I think the blade may be there.
Green glass, then, and boasting about crossing the Imagi Vert in front of the people most loyal to him, and acting mysterious and charming. When the wizard kills me over this, you can carry the guilt.
What news from the war? Seaman asked, and his tone said he already knew. The swamping of Loon Channel, the murder of Prince Talon, the starvation in Kai Sao Station. A question that carries its own answer argues something more than its words. The thief understood. The payout justifies the risk, the bald man said to the boy. I never said otherwise. We start tomorrow, then, the boy said, and left, closing the door behind him. I already started today, the thief muttered to an empty room. King Ron took the throne, and with it control of the empire, a week before his 20th name day. A boy, still with the glow of youth in his skin, he sat in a chair of gold and gemstones and bones. He ruled for 6 decades, through peace and strife, famine and plenty. Many people born on the day of his ascension lived out their whole lives not knowing any other ruler. The idea of governance and King Ron grew together in the minds of his subjects like 2 saplings planted side by side, twining around each other until neither could exist without the other. King Ron and the empire and the right function of the world all name the same thing. Easy enough, then, to forget the man who bore that weight. He alone of everyone from the Sea of Pearls to the Knife Peak Daidao Mountains, the ice sheets of High Saral to the deserts of the Heliopon, understood that the man called King Ron, who controlled the empire as a normal person commanded their own hands, and the one named Ron Salvo Seriadin, born of Ash Salvo, princess of High Saa, and 3rd wife to King Gaudin, did not share everything. The man and the office that demanded all his days only appeared at peace with each other. If anything, death's shadow oppressed him more than it did others, because he could not pretend that more power and influence would bring a deeper meaning to his life. Wealth and status could not dispel the questions that haunted him. He sought his consolation in sex and philosophy and, near the end, the occult. The sex led to a legion of children, both within and outside the political labyrinths of marriage. The philosophy, to a series of melancholy letters which detailed his conception of the human soul and the nature of a well-lived life. And the occult, inevitably, to his friendship with the Imagi Vert. The Imagi Vert, a name that conjured up a whole mythology of threats and wonders, even more than the bodiless voice of the stone oracle of Calafi, or the night children that played in the waves off the coast of Amphos. The Imagi Vert embodied the deeper mysteries of the world. Some claimed that the Imagi began life as a human and suffered transformation by falling down a cliff and into a flaw in the universe. Others, that God could not breathe life into the clay of the world without opening a crack between heaven and earth. And the scar from that wound took a name and a tower and a circle of land for itself. Or that a great wizard cheated death itself by learning to live backward to the beginning of all things. All the different versions agreed on 3 things. The Imagi held the Mocking Tower and the land around it inviolate. Those who sought to bend the Imagi to mere human will ended poorly. And wonders beyond the understanding of the most outlandish imagination lay hidden in the shadow of that changing and eternal tower. King Ron's study of the occult drew him to the low stone wall and the town and the tower as inevitably as water running down. No one can know the nature of that first meeting, but many have guessed. Perhaps the emperor could only experience humility before the ageless, timeless thing that called the Mocking Tower home. Or perhaps 2 people set so far above humanity that power became isolation, more resembled refugees in a vast wilderness clinging to each other. No one witnessed the time those 2 kept in each other's company, and King Ron shared little with his court. His trips to the Mocking Tower became first a yearly pilgrimage, then once in the high summer and another in winter's depth. And then, as his years thinned him and travel from the palaces became impossible, a beloved memory that outlasted all others. Death came to King Ron, as with anyone. The throne of empire did not exempt him. Physicians came from every corner of the world bearing vials of salt and herb, charms and chants and leeches. King Ron allowed them all to minister to him, like an uncle indulging his nieces and nephews in their games. If he held any real hope of prolonging his life, he didn't express it. The princes and princesses gathered around the palaces. The eldest, Prince Kenan, bore his diadem on hair already grown thin and pale by 58 years of life. Princess Magrin, the youngest present, still wore braids like a child, celebrating a youth she had not quite outgrown. The palaces grew dense with the volume of servants and wealth and ambition, like a tick ready to pop with blood. At the moment of his death, a darkness passed over the palaces. The torches and lamps and the fires in their grates all shuddered and went out. Some claim to have heard the sound of wings, as if the blackness hid a vastness of huge birds. Others, a low musical whistling that came from the walls themselves. Only King Ron's nurse and Prince Tawan, who fortune placed at his bedside, heard King Ron's last words.
"You remembered your promise."
And at the time, they placed no great importance upon them. When the servants finished rekindling the torches and candles, fire logs and lanterns, King Ron lay dead, and the empire changed. For a time, it seemed as if this new order might fall close to the old. The legal scholars and priests who studied the arcana of dignified bloodlines identified those of King Ron's children with just claims to the throne. As eldest, Kenan held the strongest claim, but Nos, younger but of higher-born mother, ran a near second. Then Tawan, and Clar, Mausch, and Tinnan. Princess Sarowen of Holt cut her hair and her name together, declaring herself Prince Saru, in a gesture which the priest said had many precedents. For the weeks of mourning, the empire held its breath. Then Prince Kenan announced the date of his ascension and invited his siblings to come in peace to honor the memory of the father they shared. Even now, the identity of the men who slaughtered Kenan's wife and children remained unclear. But they failed to kill the prince, and the War of Seven Princes began. In the years since the first blood spilled, only chaos reigned. News traveled across mountains and plains, lakes and oceans, and it spoke of death and loss and palace intrigue. And, sometimes, to those who cared to listen for it, of the Imagi Vert, a fisherman whose cousin worked in the palace kitchens, said that on the night of King Ron's death, when the fires died, a shape, human or nearly so, had been seen flying across the face of the moon. It came from the direction of the Mocking Tower and returned the same way. A woman traveling through the lands of the Imagi Vert at the same time reported that the townsfolk had kept inside that night, leaving the mild summer evening as empty as if a wild storm had raged. Some tales could even be verified. Yes, agents of the Imagi had sought out half a dozen of the best swordsmiths in the empire in the months of King Ron's decline. Yes, a forge had been built in the lee of the Mocking Tower. Then, a month after the death of the king, collapsed. Yes, a stranger had arrived at the library of Amon Swear in the weeks after the king's first decline and demanded an obscure treatise on the nature of the soul. Little more than whispers in a high wind. Yet the links between the Imagi Vert and the death of the king began to tell a larger tale. This new mythology began in the king's dying words and ended in one man's plan to end the war. The patchwork of truth and surmise came together this way. In his age, King Ron came to fear death, or if not fear it, at least regret its necessity. He appealed to his deathless friend and companion, the Imagi Vert. Together, they plotted a way that King Ron might shed the clay of his flesh and yet remain undying. The Imagi Vert, through means unknown to the pious, collected the king's soul when it fled his body, returned with it to the Mocking Tower, and there forged it into a sword. Steel and fire formed a blade in which Ron could escape all endings. And then, what would the wizard who lived outside of time do with such a blade? What power could a true soul sword give? Mere human guesses seemed unlikely to plumb the depths of the Imagi schemes and plots. Perhaps the sword gave some advantage 1,000 years hence. Perhaps it only offered the pleasure of accomplishing a task no other alchemist dared to hazard. But for the heirs of the empire? For the men and women and children who faced the prospect of war? It was an object of even greater power. And so, in the capital of a small nation, where King Ron had made one of his last visits, in the home of a woman who almost 2 decades before had been charged with the raising of young Prince Aus, the heir farthest from his father's throne, built schemes of his own. He had lived alone his whole life, knowing nothing of his father and mother beyond a direction over the sea, and an assurance that his blood gave him honor and dignity, if not love. He covered the fine stone walls in charcoal and wax as he mapped out his journey, the paths of his little armies, the 8th in the War of 7 Princes, and the one with the least hope of victory in the field. The field did not concern him. For Aus, the path of victory wound through no battlefields, only the gardens and grounds of the Mocking Tower, the ruins where ivy already overgrew the charred bones of a forge, a temple of green glass, the streets and stables, mills and kitchens and farmyards of the lands that no king claimed. There, or nowhere, lay the key to the ambitions of Aus, the forgotten prince. Aus, whose name was not Seaman.
"I have always had a fondness for green glass," the thief said, and smiled knowingly.
The woman standing before him, dark-haired and broad-shouldered, rested her axe on her shoulder and said nothing. The thief smiled, as if the two of them were sharing a joke, tipped his wide-brimmed hat, and moved on down the street. The town betrayed no trace of its eerie status, apart from the Mocking Tower itself. Men and women went about the business of their days here, as they would anywhere. Dogs and children chased each other over rough stone paving and through wide puddles of standing mud. Birds watched from the tree branches, thick with leaves. So long as the constantly changing tower remained hidden, forgetting it seemed possible, and the thief found ways to keep the tower out of sight. A thick-faced man hauling a cartload of fresh-cut hay made his way along the street, a creature of soft grunts and sweat. The thief stepped in front of him.
"A fine morning. I wonder, friend, if you might know something interesting about green glass. I have good silver to trade for good words."
The hauler paused, scowled, and shrugged his shoulders before he shoved on. The thief smiled after him, as if his reticence told a clearer tale than all the eloquence in the world. He drew an old tin sextant from his robe, hung a plumb line with a lump of green, bright crimson glass for a bob, and pretended to take readings of the tops of the trees. He felt like an idiot, and a frightened one at that. He expected to end the day face down in a ditch with fish eating his eyes. But he also took his work seriously. So he made a mysterious ass of himself and hoped for the best without being too specific about what that best might be. In the stables, Prince Aus played at seaman, nodding and helping wherever he found a chance, and above all else, listening. The keeper to his wife as they tended to the grapevines behind the main house.
Of course I sent word to the tower. Went there myself as soon as I saw him off to his room. Expect the Imagi knew well before I said anything, though.
The cleaning girl to her mother, as they walked toward the market with the day's eggs.
The Imagi sent instructions in the night. Little finches with hollowed eyes that carried bits of parchment in their beaks. Beer,
who Seaman knew as the blacksmith's apprentice,
got one. And so did Soilu.
One of the little girls, wearing as much mud as dress, as she clapped her hands in the filthy water by her house.
Thieves and rats, and all of us are blades and cats.
Everyone knew, as Seaman hoped they would. But if any panicked, he didn't see it. Like a man walking toward a dog on a road at twilight, the town watched, calm and steady, as it judged the threat. But at least it felt threatened, or amused, or at least interested. Of his greatest fears, boredom, complacence, indifference, he saw nothing. The thief loomed in the news of the town, and that sufficed. After lunch, when Seaman traditionally slipped away to the hayloft for a long nap, Prince Aus slipped away down the track that pretended to be a deer trail. He walked carefully, his ears straining over the buzzing of summer flies and the hushing of the high grass. The midday heat drenched him with sweat, and the thick air went into his lungs like steam. The mocking tower shifted, a spiral of smooth white stones reaching to the sky. A pair of massive yellow curves nesting one within the other like the beak of an impossible huge bird. A single uncarved block of smoke.